against a mic. Excellent.
Oh, you brought this back?
Yeah.
Their own personal.
Yeah, he does not make that distinction.
No, I walked the they're going to the same
station.
Good morning. Call to order this 58th meeting of New Jersey Highlands Water Protection and Planning Council. My name is John Weingarth. I live in Surgeonsville in Hunterdon County.
Elizabeth Calabrese, Hunterdon County Freeholder. Good morning.
Eric Peterson, Hunterdon County Freeholder.
Debbie Pasquarelli, Warren County Representative, Greenwich Township.
Jack Schleyer, Morris County Freeholder.
Bill Conger, Manchester Township.
Tracy Carluccio, Hunterdon County Public Representative.
Janice Kovach, Town of Clinton, Hunterdon County.
This meeting was advertised in accordance with the Open Public Meetings Act. All who wish, please rise and pledge allegiance.
Pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
We We have a quorum just barely, and I don't think we have enough members to approve the minutes from the last meeting, so we'll put that aside for the moment. I'd just like to congratulate the members of the council who were on the ballot on Tuesday, who all got reelected. Liz, I guess Aisha was also.
Congratulations.
Congratulations. So the Highlands Council continues that no member of the council who was already in office has been defeated. So that's a result of being on the council. Any members have anything to report at this time? I would say since we had eight members present and we may have one or two more joining us that we'll go through the full agenda and go through all the issues we're talking about. This is a work session, as have the last several been, so I don't anticipate any votes that for any issues that will require a vote. We can have straw votes as needed to get a sense of the feelings of the people who are here. The tenth item on the agenda has been removed or postponed, the review of the proposed water quality management plan amendment. The applicant, the Heritage 55, has asked that we postpone that, and we will take it up at a meeting in December after we get through the draft regional management plan.
I think that because we've only seen each other a short time ago, we were all here a week ago, I think that we could just go into the presentation on the RMP progress.
All right, let's do that. I would thank the staff for getting the material ready for this meeting. I mean, not only is it that we met a week ago, but one of those days was a state holiday, so there have only been a small number of working days since we were here. And I think everyone's aware our next scheduled meeting is a week from Monday, November 19th at 4 p.m.
As we have been doing in these past meetings, and we have a PowerPoint which is really to highlight the important areas of the various documents, any changes, any issues that we believe that the Council should be really focused their attention on. We did have some amazing computer issues this morning, which made it very exciting getting to this point. So I am going to say that if there are a couple of glitches in the PowerPoint, because there's some visuals that have movies as part of them. So I want to sort of start off by saying that that's my way of anticipating any difficulties we have, but hopefully it will go smoothly. The first thing we'd like to discuss with you this morning is the land use capability map. I'm sure I've saw that I can make the room that many of the public have been focusing on the maps on the wall. All of these have been shown to you in full on a PowerPoint with the exception of the land use capability zone map. So today we are releasing these in this format. We do not have the shape files as yet because we want to wait for direction from the council. This is obviously for your consideration if you do release these as part of the next generation regional master plan or the next draft. Then they will be available after the date that you do that in full form so that people can, they can be downloaded and by others and used in that format. So that would be, at this point, we see after the 19th. There is a requirement in the Highlands Act that the Council prepare a land use capability map. And to address this requirement, what we're suggesting to members of the Council is that we would be releasing a series of maps, and mainly because the level of information that we have available is actually too much to graphically display on one map. So to get to that issue, in the 2006 draft, you had the zone map, which was termed the LUCM, the Land Use Capability Map, and we did receive many comments on that it didn't get to capability and capacity. Now, the land use capability zone map that we have that we've shown you and talked about at our last meeting does, in fact, get to capability issues. And that is why we ended up with those constrained zones showing those as well. So it does show a level of capability. But further to that map, you need to also look at the other issues, which are water availability, the water systems, public community water systems, domestic sewerage, and the septic system yield. So what we did is we have those displayed around the room. There are five of them. I'll take you through them on the slide. The first is that land use capability zone map, which shows now the three primary zones, protection, conservation, and existing community, and then has the subzones, which are the existing community constrained subzone, the conservation constrained subzone, and the lake community subzone. And this is all very much in response to comments received from the public, from various groups, and from yourselves. The second map in the series is the water availability map. We did go over this with you at the last meeting. This map shows net water availability by HUC 14 and also shows the conditional net water availability. That's that 1% and 2% that we spoke of with the 125% mitigation requirement. We have the public community water systems map, which again shows where those systems, where they serve, and the capacity. Likewise, the domestic sewerage facilities map. That's four of five. And the final one is the land use capability septic system yield map. This is for the planning area, conservation and protection zones only. Now again, those maps were all discussed at the last meeting. The purpose today, though, is to show them as a series to show land use capability. The final slide here is a slide that was designed by our GIS unit. It will loop, so you can see it again. But what it really shows is the zone progression. You see on the bar to the up on the upper left of the slide, the green is the protection zone. The yellow is existing community zone. The sort of a grayish one, that's the conservation zone. And then you see the three subzones filling in as well. And this shows the progression and the resolution, conflict resolution of the map. In the first go-round, about 70% of the land using the primary indicators fell into either protection, the three primary zones, protection, conservation, and existing community zone. And the final area that comes up are the lake communities, which is the lake community zone, which is where your 1,000-foot buffer lake management areas intersects with existing community zone. So it shows where a certain level of development exists around those acres, those lakes of 10 acres or greater. That brings me to the end, I think. Of the map series.
Mr. Chairman, I just had a question before you go into lake management. I think it would be helpful to try to get a clear picture of what standards are attached to the environmentally constrained subzones. If they were put together in one place in the plan, are we going to be doing that? Because I haven't seen that. And you know, the last meeting, a couple of us were asking, you know, exactly what is attached in terms of standards and what can you or can you not do in these new subzones, which are great, you know, totally support that we have a more refined zone mapping. But I have not been able to sort it out in terms of understanding exactly what standards are attached. I do see in the last round of documents that we received, it is being mentioned in various places that the environmentally constrained subzone, you can or cannot do this. But we haven't done that all along since this is new. So how are we going to, you know, fully comprehend what can and cannot happen in these subzones?
What I would answer to that is that they primarily are designed to be a tool to show that there are constraints even in these zones, and that when we're dealing in conformance with municipalities, they will be used then to determine conformance and determine the standards, because they really give alert municipalities and all that will be working with us, the counties as well, obviously, that there are further constraints that need to be considered in planning. But those particular constraints then need to be examined on the ground. Because, for example, if it's critical habitat, you have to do an analysis to see does that is there actual habitat on these sites, and that would then determine the kind of planning. So it's sort of flagging the attention to those areas, primarily, that there is something that needs a further look or a further study. That's the sort of the more general answer. In certain areas, we're looking at specific, and that's what you've seen in some of these programs, but where it can be applied through a program, we're looking at sort of, again, flagging attention to it and calling into play certain different types of planning in those areas.
Can we call these out in one place in the plan?
Are you asking for, like,
a listing of what standards would be attached to these environmentally constrained subzones? For instance, I mean, if it's an environmentally constrained subzone in the conservation zone, do all the conservation zone standards apply to that? Or are there additional standards that are equal to, for instance, the protection zone?
I think our idea is that the standards apply in the environmentally constrained two areas are defined on a subject-by-subject basis, on a geographic-by-geographic basis. Where we have been able to identify general application, we have included them specifically. The programs that you have are a broad variety of them. We have a lot more specificity in the land use area because we establish some basic general rules that apply at least zone-wide throughout the region. But as we get to some of the environmentally sensitive, context is everything. And the environmentally constrained areas really are contextual, as opposed to the protection zone is a management unit of its own. The environmentally constrained zones involve smaller areas, mapped areas, that their relationship with the adjacent land use is also a part of the management. And there are provisions for the further refinement of those, how those will apply in some of the more general standards. I would be very hard, candidly, for us to produce everything we have to produce by the 19th and give you that summary. But I think after the 19th, it would be very easy for us to provide that as an informational, in an informational format, as to how we see that working.
I appreciate that. Just as a final comment, my concerns arise from the fact that so much acreage went from the protection zone into the community zone, and some of it into the environmentally constrained subzone for the community zone. And what I'm trying to assess in my mind is, are there equal environmental protections to those resources in the environmentally constrained subzone as there were in the protection, when they were in the protection zone? That's what I'm trying to figure out.
I understand your concern. I would like to observe that much of the protection zone that was previously designated as protection zone and moved out through this mapping was not really ever protection zone. I mean, the data sets and the ability to refine and apply them, we believe, did not accurately portray them. So I would just caution you that saying we took land out of the protection zone and put it in something else, when the maps were refined, the mapping criteria would have done that anyway. And what we really did was refine that, and then at the other end of the scale, go into the areas that we had painted as conservation and existing community, and identified the land that had sensitive resources that was not previously. But much of the change in the protection zone had to do with land that was really a result of the mapping, not the real land. And what happened is we got a lot better refinement, a much more precise understanding. And my view is, whenever you got to applying it to the ground, the reality was going to control. I think everybody has agreed that these maps are based on data sets, and when we get to the reality of putting it on the ground, we're going to have to recognize what's there. But that's the concept.
Well, let me ask Tracy's question from the point of view of a user of this, or a municipality evaluating the draft plan. If you see that the area you're interested in is in a conservation-constrained subzone of a conservation area, the way you figure out what that means is you look at what the policies are in the plan for conservation areas.
And the programs
and policies for the conservation constrained area.
And you will also be guided by the technical documents that are called for to be prepared, and the development, the handbooks and manuals and technical assistance, all of which will inform that process of conforming the local plan to the goals, policies, objectives, and programs of the plan.
But is it too simple a question or too difficult a question to, I think what you're saying is, if you take all that and compare that to the policies for something that's in the protection zone, what's the difference? I mean, is that a site-specific determination, or what's the difference in terms of what's allowed or what kind of analysis is done?
There are certain programs to protect large forested areas. There will be programs that will evolve for protecting small forested areas in environmentally constrained portions of the conservation and or the community, existing community, I'm sorry. But for example, we've already identified wooded corridors along public roads, and we have a specific program that very clearly identifies those. Even though they are in the environmentally constrained, we didn't call them out as environmentally constrained, but they are environmentally constrained in the maps, and we are protecting those with an explicit program. And that's why I say I don't have a problem cataloging at all. I would just ask that you allow us to produce that after the 19th.
That's good. I think you are getting to defining my question a little better. Take an example of core forest. If it's in the environmentally constrained zone of the community zone, does it have the same protections because it's a core forest as it would have if it was in the protection zone?
I think what you're going to find, and I'm looking at Dan as well to clarify this, is that the core forest would be captured within the protection zone. It wouldn't be in the conservation zone, primarily those lands. There are wooded lands, but
I think the core forest will not always be in the protection zone.
Okay.
And that's what I was, when I said earlier that be cautious about assuming that we recast four core forests, for example, from protection zone to something else. I don't think we ever did that. I think that the discipline we followed clearly adapted that area and protected.
For instance, the forest resource area was defined before the zones were ever defined. And so the forest resource area could fall in any zone. If it fell in the conservation or existing community zone, it would be a constrained area. And so there are, as Charlie was getting to, there are policies that were written to the resource and they apply wherever that resource is.
Okay.
Then there are policies that are written to the zone, and for instance, utility policies are by and large written to the zone. Mm-hmm. And so those apply wherever they are. And septic system density is written to the zone, so that applies where it is. So when you come down to what would happen in the environmental constraint, in the constrained areas, it would be a combination of the resource-based policies and the zone-based policies as applied to that land area. And the existence of the constrained area highlights the fact that that's going to be an area where a lot of different things constraining land uses are going to happen.
So you're including things like critical habitat areas.
Oh, yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah, protected. What's on the ground is protected by the program.
As opposed to,
right.
And then there are additional, more site-specific issues mm-hmm. like Highlands open water buffers and so on, where the issue is very resource-based, and it doesn't matter whether it's in a constrained area or not constrained area. It doesn't matter which zone it's in. The Highlands open water buffers are the Highlands open water buffers. So some things are going to apply at a site-specific level and don't get mapped at the regional scale.
Part of the problem, unfortunately, is that you've been seeing these in pieces, and the cumulative effect of all these programs and how they lie together. I hope.
at a minimum, we will have a table that reflects that. We'll inform all the maps and what we have available to us. So at a minimum, we will have a table and an analysis to describe that. We do have, I think, some work to be done on that, and what we talked about in the last meeting is the growth enhancement and the redevelopment potential to that zone. That gets to some of those issues as well. So the answer really is yes, at 1.9, we will be doing that. It is a result of this. But it's more of a seed. Programs are reflective of the goals, policies, and objectives, but this is the sort of the manner in which you implement them on the ground. Some of them obviously need technical documents, support documents for them, but we have to have sort of a format and a program to follow and to assist municipalities and counties in implementing the regional master plan. The first one before you today is the lake management program, and this basically is the plan now has a lake management area which goes to the 1,000-foot buffer, and that's further defined into three tiers, the first of which is the shoreline protection tier. It is all land within 300 foot of the shoreline of Highlands Lake. Again, these are lakes greater than 10 acres. And we've established some standards to protect the shoreline, and those include alteration of the shorelines, preservation and restoration of wetlands species, protection and restoration of shoreline vegetation, restrictions on new structures within 50 feet of shoreline, municipal development regulations on width and length of piers and docks and sharing of same. So what that gets to is if there's a possibility to share them, that's the way we should go with new development. Boat lifts allowing light to water so that there's a certain height so that the light can get to the water, which assists in protection. Of the lakes, and then protection buffers. That's for the shoreline protection tier. The second tier is the water quality management tier, and that's all land within 1,000 feet of the shoreline of Highlands Lake. The standards there cover landscape elements to retain stormwater, runoff directed to landscape elements to retain and filter the runoff, encouraging green roofs, impervious surfaces to drain away from shoreline, maximum use of natural swales, constructed wetlands, etc. These all get some best management practices for new development. There is, of course, the opportunity as well to look at restoration through these standards. Stormwater runoff designs to protect the quality, septic systems to comply with density requirements and with buffers from lake, clustering to be used where it provides a greater buffer from lake, and community wastewater systems to eliminate pollution by septic discharge. Grant programs and studies in support of stormwater improvement program will be made available from the Highlands Council. The third tier is the scenic resources tier. It consists of an area measuring some 300 to 1,000 feet from the shoreline. The standards there regarding building heights and natural screening of buildings from view from the lake, design standards, regulations on building on slopes, clearing of trees moved to the footprint of buildings, outdoor lighting directed away from the shoreline, and with cut-off fixtures. The Highlands Council will encourage municipalities to implement lake restoration plans, which would include the delineation of the lake's watershed, description of point and non-point pollution sources, lake monitoring schedules, in-lake management techniques, TMDLs, adopted by NGDP to address known pollution problems. Lake and dam management, the Highlands Council will implement measures working with the municipalities, implement measures to encourage the maintenance of public and private lakes and restoration of lake bed
talking with the Environmental Infrastructure Trust Fund in terms of using funding through them. And in terms of new development, making sure that we address the problem as they come up, we still have to address problems that are in existence. I don't have a full answer for you, except to say that we're working with all the areas, and it's something where I think the cost is going to be spread out between the local municipalities, in some cases property owners, but it behooves all to address the problem, and it affects the value of each of the homesteads, as well as the regional values.
No, I won't dispute that. There are many issues that arise during the course of any period of time that have a broad beneficial benefit, and open space, for example, is one of those. But open space, for a specific example, is approved by the electorate via referenda. This is not. And the legislature has not been very forthcoming with funding. Providing funding for programs such as we're introducing here, which we're going to be required of the municipalities and the entities. So if we don't have an answer, that's okay. No, I just want to know.
Are your comments specific? I mean, you're saying it's specifically the Lake Management area?
No, my comments are general.
Let me try to add to add to Eileen's response. We've tried to be very careful where there are unfunded mandates identified in this document to use the word encourage. And we encourage municipalities to implement lake restoration programs. Some have already done that, and they've found ways to fund it. And we encourage them to do that. We also have policies that this council will advocate for funding from state sources of various means or federal grants in support of that. But we've tried to be... In our drafting, the summaries may not make it really clear as we go through these, but that there are things that we would like to require, but we recognize that they have significant financial consequences. Now, some of the standards, the performance standards for development, screening buildings and stormwater management, we think can be imposed as a regulatory requirement, and they go directly to the value of the property. But we're mindful in the language, and we've tried to be clear that we say encourage when we mean it, and we use the word shall. As respectful of the financial consequences.
I think that's a fine distinction, and I appreciate that clarification. It does still pose a question mark over some heads, and I think that...
Yeah. Well, there's a big question mark over all this entire program, because there are significant financial implications that are going to have to be addressed, and they will require the support of their goals, policies, and objectives to identify financial responsibilities of both the state and the federal government in achieving the goals, policies, and objectives of this plan. And our role as a council is to advocate for that and to demonstrate that there is sound reason and that there is a good benefit that will be returned to the community at large for those public investments.
Thank you.
Questions on lakes management?
Sorry. I didn't feel the
Yes, can I just start by?
Yep.
The next program we're going to talk about is cluster development, and there are two slides, and then we have some visuals for you. I will apologize for all the writing on this, but we felt this was important because you made it. Yeah, I know. And this is the first of two. The second one isn't quite so, but it's because we did work a lot of work in response to your comments and questions on standards, so that we could implement clustering and it would become something that was implementable on the land. Also, to say to you that the visuals, I think, will make it clear the value. So there's a series of slides we'll take you through in this case.
We start in this summary of the program with cluster development general provisions. These are basic principles that we are recommending be included in your programs for clustering in implementing the plan. And I think there's no secret that I, as a professional, and Lane Kendig, who is here, have been very active in promoting. What if we could do it all over again? I wouldn't even use the word clustering. I'd call them environmental site design standards, environmentally sensitive site design standards. We use the word clustering because when zoning first emerged, we attached the concept of land use controls, we attached it to subdivision regulations because that was what was enabled. And that's where this minimum lot size requirement came from. I think if we were starting anew to build a land use regulatory system in this country, we would have never used minimum lot size because it makes no sense in terms of, because the land just doesn't fit. The most efficient lot size doesn't conform to the land. So in some ways, clustering is an anomaly. We used it, frankly, because it was in the document that we started with in November. But having said that introduction, the first is that the goal should be that building sites, that's the portion of the land that's actually developed for building sites, ought to be no more than 20%. And to the extent we can encourage it to be smaller, we should do so and provide flexibility to allow that. But the goal should be an 80% conservation strategy. The second is, and I'm not going to...
So what's on the slide is essentially on page 4 and 5 of the handout.
That's correct.
Everything in the slides is actually taken from your programs, so that, but it serves as a guide for us to guide the conversation and highlight the important issues.
The second element is that if there are contiguous lands which are owned in common ownership, they ought to be developed in a single cluster, not in multiple clusters, because each cluster is going to have access roads and curb cuts and all those sorts of things. And so we're encouraging that if there are two parcels of land, plan them together. Try to consolidate, save as much money on infrastructure, preserve as much contiguous open space as possible.
That would depend on ownership.
Of course. Common ownership. It would have to be in common ownership. But if they are in common ownership, let's work together and not let that artificial boundary that somebody drew on the lot prevent us from doing the most environmentally sensitive design on the property. The third is develop the land which has the lowest natural resource value and will minimize the amount of impervious surfaces. And so when you're rating the land, you use that which has the lowest natural resource value. And by natural resource value, we mean the forest resource area, critical habitat, steep slopes, prime groundwater recharge and open waters on a general basis. There are some special areas with regard to agricultural clusters, but those are the general propositions. No increase in density unless the property is using HDCs, transferable development rights from the Highlands Development Credit Program. Clustering should not be a vehicle whereby you get a density bonus or to increase the use of the property. It's the wise location of those units on the property subject to environmental performance standards. At least that's as we have conceived and presented it. Access roads should avoid lands of ag lands and high-value natural resource lands. While the length of the road is of concern always, it's more important as does it interrupt a system on the land, the use of agricultural land or a natural system. So that we'd rather have a longer road that avoids the wetland and the steep slope than a short road that goes straight up the hill. Clusters on septic tanks, we think a fairly rare phenomenon in this region, must meet the dilution model targets of 10 milligrams per liter for the developed area. That is, no matter, it has to still be the overall septic capacity of the watershed. But on site, on the 20% or 10%, whatever it is that's developed, it can't exceed the 10 milligram at the borders of that of the developed component. So we're still meeting the overall standard on a watershed basis, but on the local basis, we're saying you can't make it so compact that you exceed that 10 milligram in any circumstance. The third is, as you know, we anticipate that there will be sewers. We have discussed at some length that sewers would have to be extended from available. It has to be adjacent to existing sewered areas. There is some additional language that's included, and I don't have the page on it, but we are recommending that circumstances where clustering is a desirable pattern of development, which is not adjacent, and understand, all of the clustering says this property has an entitlement under whatever set of rules apply to put a certain number of units. as we see clustering, it's how to put those units which are already authorized, in the most appropriate form to best protect the Highlands resources. And we're not suggesting that you ought to have more land, more development. Whatever that development entitlement is under the law, that's what you ought to be doing. And that in circumstances where it's not adjacent to the existing community, we're suggesting that they ought to be able to provide alternative wastewater system to serve the clustered development, which is already entitled, but there have to be protections to ensure that it doesn't lead to service of adjacent properties, accelerating unplanned growth, and that it's confined in a legally enforceable manner to ensure that it doesn't have any unintended consequences. But we'd rather do that in these ag areas particularly, rather than continuing to discharge more in, nitrates into the system that's already stressed. And so we've made in here included explicitly that we believe alternative technology to septic tanks and clustered development is alternative technology is preferable. Ideally, we'd confine it to existing adjacent properties, but we're trying to strike a balance. And this is, if you look on the page two of the policies and objectives addressed, objective 2K3F in the new numbering system is the source for that in our with those new systems, by the way, there is a limit on impervious surface for if it's an agricultural cluster on the balance of the land in terms of impervious surface on the agriculture. We told you that if it's got on septics in the agricultural area, there's got to be best management practices to reduce nitrate loadings on the agricultural side, and if it's on sewer or alternative technologies, there's a limitation on impervious surface, again, to make sure that we are making a positive, having a positive outcome on overall nitrate contributions.
Maybe you're going to ask the same question. What is that percent limit? You're talking about a percent limit on impervious surfaces for the agricultural area that's left?
Yes.
And because that was a comment that I made. What is it? That's on
3%.
Thank you.
Things like detention basins and that kind of infrastructure on the cluster, is that considered part of the 20% area or is that part of the 80% area?
It's in the 20% area.
That would be have to be within the 20% area. In terms of ownership of the 80% area, typically that stays with the homeowners association, but one of the issues that I see is...
For a farmer.
How does a farmer farm with a homeowners association? If it's left to open space or woodlands, what is the mandate to make sure that that's maintained? I mean, a lot of times what can happen is you wind up with vacant space that nobody wants to invest any money in, that the municipality or the county can't come in and take care of, and it really just fills up with invasive species. And
what we're in this program, what we're suggesting is that the appropriate covenants and restrictions for the land which is not developed in the cluster will be recorded on a site-by-site basis, because it really does relate to what the individual parcel is. If it's a farmer, there's a limitation that might be in position of the 3% and some spacing requirements around the cluster to protect the residential, because you want it to be a win-win situation both ways. If it's open space, we certainly recommend that, and I think there are other land preservation programs that say that there ought to be a identification of how that land, which is open space, is going to be managed. And it could be for an individual homeowner who wants, homeowners association that wants to, but there also needs to be a custodian in case they don't. That's at least our view.
Can we also say that it's not just simply clustering, as we term it, it's also open lands ratio, so it actually could be, under open lands ratio, you could have an owner of the farm and those lands, and then the development clustered. So the farmer would, that's open lands ratio form of clustering.
You can separate the ownership?
Yes. There's also lot size averaging that could be used here, and that's called out in the issue overview on your paper on cluster development. So that cluster development is sort of the name for various types or ways that you can actually do this kind of clustering and end up with different ownerships on that those open lands.
This gets again to the point that Charlie raised before, that the term clustering has a legal definition, but the concept is actually broader than that. If you cluster, according to the municipal land use law, then the ownership has to be either the homeowners association or the municipality. But if you cluster physically, but do it through lot size averaging, then the large lot can remain in private ownership with a deed restriction on it. So that's this difficulty with terminology.
That's why I started off with my definition, because we want to really promote entrepreneurship in how these preserved lands will be managed and aggregated and creative solutions to try to link adjacent parcels, et cetera. And there's a number of policies that go to promoting that over time, in addition to what we have here. The last,
we're talking about, it's being proposed that we run sewer lines into protection zones. Is that what we're talking about here? Do I see the cord for the trees to serve higher density development in clustered areas? Is that, in essence, what we're talking about?
This is a policy that you've had from 2006 as well, and if the existing area is served...
Controversial one, I might point out. Well, I want to make sure I'm understanding, because, you know, our email had 19 attachments trying to prepare for this meeting, and as hard as I try and work, I can't always see the forest for the trees. So I want to make sure that is what we're talking about.
But let me answer the question. That is a policy that I think that we have followed since it was previously made. But we are, as staff and consultants, comforted by the reality that the circumstance of extending a sewer to a cluster in a protection zone would be extremely unique and would involve a very large parcel of land and an enormous amount of conservation. And if that were to happen, particularly in the preservation area, it's most likely to happen, if ever, in the planning area, that the balance probably makes sense. If in order to make it work, that balance, but it's not going to be, given the number of units that are likely to be available in the protection zone and meeting all the other performance standards, none of which are waived, would be an extremely rare circumstance. And in fact, I bet it's likely to never happen.
Well, as somebody who has been responsible for managing wastewater capacity and allocations in a rural area, I'm not so confident it's impossible. And the reason why I'm bringing this up is it all sounds wonderful on paper, but in reality, there's a grave risk for extension of these sewer areas and even from alternative wastewater. And you said we would put things, I forget your exact words, safeguards in place. I maintain that's impossible. When we start doing this, we're going to end up in 15 years somewhere other than we're all sitting around and thinking we're going to end up. So what are you suggesting? More specifically, first of all, when you say just to make sure we're on the same page, when you say alternative wastewater methods, wastewater control methods, not showing the word, and safeguards, could you elaborate on that, what you're thinking?
Well, let's start with the safeguards. There are things like who owns the transmission line, capacity limitation, who owns the transmission line, who has the right to enforce. We would suggest that there be some third party, at least some third party interest other than the Highlands Council and some other public agency who has enforcement abilities to enforce if they wish to. Capacity constraints on the transmission line. In terms of actual limitations, and I think we would suggest that ought to be, we would take the position, I think, contrary to you, that as long as there is a legally enforceable means of ensuring that unintended consequences, that is extensions of service through that transmission line to some other or from that facility, if it happens to be a freestanding facility in terms of an alternative technology facility, a package plant that meets DEP standards, et cetera, whatever mousetrap can be invented that can be enforced and enforced in a meaningful way would be acceptable under these standards.
And that's what I'm saying. I don't see how under laws you can do that, because it's controlled by a governing body, and in one election, all it takes is one election for a governing body to change, and there's nothing that can be done that can't be undone. And so you have to, for something that's undone to be redone. And I would say to the council that, you know, in its most elemental form, the Highlands Act is to control development. I mean, that's what directed in appropriate areas. So we need to think really, really carefully about this. And again, it was in the previous draft. We all didn't agree with everything that was in there. We agreed to release it for comment. This, I think, is a very critical issue and very integral to what our mission is here. And we need to think very carefully about this before we may be providing for unintended consequences and not realizing.
I think the one critical issue that I would point out is that you start with the yield of the property not using sewage, and you are then clustering that yield and providing potentially some sort of community system or development specific system, or if you're adjacent to existing service area, an extension, but only then. So you always start with the yield of the property as if it were not sewered, and that's where you stop. So the question is, how are you placing that development on the ground? And you don't, it's not beyond that. It's not an intensification of use. It's a layout issue.
Well, I think it would be interesting. I mean, I think that point's important, but I think what Debbie's question is getting at is the enforceability of the enforceability of any restriction that we place on a sewer line, a sewer extension or a sewer line. And it'd be interesting to know examples where that's worked, where, I mean, I think there are
examples.
It's not, because you can put a deed restriction or other legal restrictions on it that are not subject to a change by the next election.
That's what I asked. We have done
lots of programs where the covenants and restrictions, the legal rights are enforceable by multiple governmental agencies, so that a single agency can't do it unilaterally, and by individual property owners, and often in third party beneficiaries. If in the cluster agreement we have a conservation organization that agrees to assume management responsibility of the open space that's protected, they become a beneficiary. And so in order to change the covenant in regard to the utilities, they have to join in it. And we are anticipating that you will have, that if this circumstance arises, you will use those kinds of protections, and I will just tell you from my experience, in fact, some of the things we did 25 years ago, I now wish I hadn't been so clever at, because we now know that septic tanks in some circumstances aren't nearly as bad as we once thought they were, but they can be, I promise, made enforceable. If you just do it on the standard, what's required by the land use law, municipal land use law, you won't get there. But I think there are plenty of ways. And what we're suggesting is, again, all of this is in the context. In the protection zone, you're talking about a very rare circumstance. Limit density needed to what they have without. And those are very small numbers.
Mr. Chairman, yeah. I wanted to get back for a minute to the density issue, and I had one question. In the requirement of meeting 10 milligrams per liter on the developed cluster site, that figure is arrived at by a model. So will there also be, I know I've asked this before, but I just want to make sure I understand. Will that also be applied at each well site? Let's say we have a cluster and it's on septic systems and individual wells in the agricultural, in the conservation zone. It's an agricultural cluster. Under the Private Well Testing Act, there needs to be an analysis to make sure that all the state standards are met, and one of those is the 10 milligrams per liter for nitrates. So I assume each well will be tested for meeting those standards, and of course we have even if the model, we're not relying just on the model, we're also relying on those test results. Is that correct?
Well, before we're relying on the test results, there are policies with regard to the cluster, and that's the 10 milligrams per liter, but then there are other policies, either policies, objectives, one of the two, elsewhere in the goals, policies, and objectives that get to the issue of site design, because I can design a site at 10 milligrams per liter that is both horrible for or protective of the wells within that septic system. It's all a matter of layout. So the key is you get your building envelope, if you will, through the 10 milligrams per liter. You then design that in a way that minimizes the chance for contamination of the wells by the septic systems. And then the Private Well Testing Act and actually Board of Health regulations require initial testing of the well and then testing of the well at every change of ownership.
Okay,
so
now,
those issues right. will all be there.
Now, let's say we have a situation where we go through that entire exercise, and when the wells are put, and the wells are in, and they do the Board of Health testing, which is done after the construction is complete, and we have an exceedance of 10 milligrams per liter of nitrates, what do we do? Are we going to allow that each of those wells be fitted, for instance, with a POET system or some sort of treatment system in order to bring it down below the standard?
State regulations with regard to provision of water supply would apply, and in those cases, the if they initially are above 10 milligrams per liter, that's because of pre-existing conditions. That has nothing to do with the septic system density, of course, because the septic systems aren't operating yet. So it could be a situation where you had agricultural uses previously existing on the property or something like that. The state does have requirements with regard to making sure that those wells meet all requirements, and if that requires a point-of-use treatment system, then that's what would be implemented by
the
developer.
This situation, the reason I'm asking the questions, and I understand what you're saying now, is because I believe that we could provide a much safer approach to this by applying the 2 milligram per liter standard that applies to the zone to the development site. Because in that way, we'll be providing a margin of safety for those wells. And the reason I say that is the analysis of what is actually going to come into the person's home from that well is not done until after the development is built. And unless we have a margin of safety built into the nitrate concentration that we're allowing, we may be very well setting up with these agricultural cluster developments exceedances in regards to nitrates. And I think you're absolutely right, Dan. In many of these areas, the problems with nitrates are associated with the historic use by agriculture. And we know from the statistics that have been produced by the plan that those are the very areas in the highlands that have the higher concentrations. And so I brought this up in previous meetings, but I did additionally on this last round of editing suggest that under the objective that was, I think, differently numbered now, 2L2E, that we change that language to say that the new residential development utilizing septic systems for lot size averaging clustering open space subdivision design techniques or employed shall have a gross density based on the nitrate dilution target appropriate for the LUCM zone and for the specific development site, and that the wells serving the development are to meet the 10 milligrams per liter. And I just think this would provide for us the margin of safety we need to have the comfort that we are not going to be relying simply on these modeling exercises in order to protect and not build system clusters in agricultural areas that are going to be a problem. So I know this will most likely be an amendment.
What you were adding there were after for the land use building map zone and for the particular site? Was that the chapter?
Yes, and for the specific development site. And I think, you know, that we can also, and I expect to be offering an amendment having to do with how we calculate our septic density numbers, too, is I think this also harkens back to that. And we can, you know, there's different ways to skin the cat. We could have address it through that as well, and that is a suggestion that I had made, but the staff has not accepted, which is that we add the factor in that GSR 32 allows for a factor based on the lawn or remaining land contribution of nitrates, other sources of nitrates other than the septic system. And that then could also be a way that we provide a margin of safety. We're not doing that now. It's technically feasible. It's built into GSR 32. It's an easy thing to do. It's not a big technical jump. It's not using a different model. There is a factor, input in GSR 32, and I will suggest next week an amendment that we allow and require that to be done when the GSR 32 model is being run, because we're going to end up here having cluster developments. We're not going to be considering the nitrate contributions from the remaining land or from any other source other than the septic system, and we're going to be relying on these modeling exercises, which, frankly, I just do not have confidence in.
Can I just say, Mr. Chair, that the staff always, we consider the comments we receive from council members, and where we know, where we see that they've caught something, that something we've omitted, some sort of consistency, we address it. When it becomes a policy issue, we bring it back to the council because we feel that's appropriate, unless we think that the recommendation is such that the staff would then change their recommendation and bring it to you as a change. In terms of the clustering using septics with the 10 milligram per liter target, that brings us to 1.9 acres, I believe, per unit. So I'd say that to you. Anything, if you change that, anything, I would question if it is a cluster. And certainly what we're recommending is really more the sewered or the waste treatment, the package plants. We think that's the more appropriate way to do this. And remembering that what we're doing, again, we have to keep reiterating this, is taking the number of development units that could be developed and just doing them in a more, we believe, environmentally protective way by clustering them and therefore protecting a larger area. And I remind you of the debate on one of the wastewater quality management plans that was brought before you, where we looked at when there was an existing area served being expanded, and that was an opportunity, instead of having one unit per 3 acres sewered, to cluster that down and relieve the pressure on other lands, taking preserving those and protecting those other lands. So that's where we're going with that. And on the modelling, and we Tracy has talked to staff about this as well. We did account for four people per unit, which is more than is the average in the area, and that we believed would account for the nitrates that we weren't including in the modelling, like lawns, etc. And you know what the yield was. We've delivered that to you. So staff is staying with its recommendations. Of course, the decision is yours to redirect us.
Well, let me insist, Tracy, because I'm puzzled by why your concerns are raised, particularly by cluster development, we all keep saying we're talking about the same number of units on a site, but being located more consistently with smart growth principles and planning principles and all that. Why that raised your concern?
Well, certainly clustering and open lands ratio approaches where you're saving the land and not having these large lots that are spread out across the land is better. Mm-hmm. But it's still development. That's right. My concern. And when we're clustering, particularly using septic systems, then we're concentrating nitrates. And we are calculating what that concentration is going to be based on a model that I believe is not safe enough. So that's my concern.
So that would mean that you would support building out the whole area as opposed to clustering?
No, I'm not saying that. I'm saying
if you drop it down, then the only way to achieve that is by larger lot size.
No, not necessarily.
Okay.
Maybe we don't want clusters in the agricultural area unless they are adjacent or within an existing wastewater and water sewer, water service area. I did suggest another edit to that effect, which is the policy, it was 3C2, I think it is still policy C3-2 in the paper today, to say that mandatory clustering or open space design development as approved by the Highlands Council to be allowed only on land adjacent to existing water and wastewater infrastructure. And I think if we take the approach of clustering and allow it only where it is adjacent to, and not proximate to, I think we need to use the words adjacent to, existing water and wastewater infrastructure, then I think it makes sense.
Trace, where are you reading that from? I'm sorry, Bill.
It's in our document. It's policy 3.
Page 3 of the document.
Page 3, the top of the page.
And is it numbered?
C.
3C2.
Thank you. Sorry.
Okay. Well, I think we're not going to come to agreement on this today, but I think Tracy said you're every amendment. And I'd say to all members, if there are amendments you anticipate ahead of time you're going to be bringing up, the more you can put those in writing before the 19th, or that would be helpful to all of us. But not essential.
If you don't mind, I'd like to ask staff if you are still comfortable with your recommendations here, having heard what Tracy has said. Tracy is extremely articulate and knowledgeable in these areas. She raises some interesting issues. Are you still convinced that the approach that you have offered to us is consistent with the comfort level that we hope to achieve here and has enough safety built into it? I'm just bringing it down to the...
Absolutely. But in the context of the Act provides for a multiple of goals and objectives to be achieved, and among those are agricultural activities. And our experience is that long-term agricultural preservation is enhanced by the clustering tool, proper use of the clustering tool. And we're confident that Dan has given fair consideration, probably more than fair consideration, to all of the water quality implications.
And staff have had discussions on all suggestions from council, and we do stand with our recommendations.
And we have, just to make sure, we have re-debated it every time anyone has raised the question, and as late as last evening, we talked about it again.
Are there other comments on this section?
The next is just to emphasize a few points. We've talked about most of these going through. In the protection zone, it's really critical to say that the clustering is at the densities that are based on septic system. That's a key component. It's not intended to open up land for development. It's intended to say we have something and we have a better way we can accommodate it through clustering. We strongly encourage, and we've recommended the plan strongly encourage the protection of agriculture and highlands through clustering. The presence of prime soils and land used for active agriculture should be considered to be high-value resources in addition to the others in the conservation area. We did not make that a fact in the protection area. The agricultural uses shall be required to use best management practice to reduce nutrient and chemical loading rates if there are going to be a cluster on agricultural lands. The land not being used as building sites shall be preserved in perpetuity and used for agricultural uses or natural resource preservation. And the standards and criteria may be adjusted during municipal conformance, provided that you all find that the adjustments are consistent with the goals, policies, and objectives of the Highlands Regional Master Plan, and the adjustments provide comparable protection for the Highlands ecosystem. And again, we've tried to set out some fairly clear standards, but on the other hand, we're ultimately going to ask the municipalities to administer these things, and we think it's appropriate that there be some capability to implement some modifications to these, which could be more restrictive or, in some cases, modifications that would be acceptable. And that's this. I did fail to mention there is a provision on the prior page, and I just want to make sure that where cluster development is adjacent to an existing settlement, a hamlet or a village, that setbacks along the road and other kinds of site standards would reflect that adjacent community and not be automatically the standards that are in this to respect the local character of the community. In all zones, obviously, protection from natural landscape and setbacks from roads are provided for. But the roads, the existing character along the roads is really important, and we want to make sure that clustering doesn't have the impact of affecting both the scenic quality and the environmental character of those landscapes, which are an important part of the Highlands landscape. That's, I believe, the discussion. Now, we just have done, Lane and his company have done a couple of, two examples. These have really looked at, okay, let's assume at somewheres, this would obviously be most likely to be the planning area, protection zone cluster, where there's a relatively large parcel line, 61.7 acres, an existing allocated density of about a little less than one unit per 7 acres, how a cluster development of this property would be undertaken under what we've described in the standards. And if anything here is this first one, you've seen it from a planar view. This is identifying the road. The road appears to be relatively long as we go into it, but it is an attempt to show that we're avoiding wetlands and other resources on the property. It brings you around into and then shows you where, how the cluster would relate, and this brings you back to see what it looks like in its entirety in terms of the overall landscape. And this is a real parcel of land that was just identified, and assuming it had this level of intensity, which we think is relatively high, though it's clearly within the existing policy framework that we're operating, particularly in the planning areas, of what you might experience. Then there is another site. This is an agricultural site. You can see from a planar view where the cluster has been located. This is a comparable base density analysis. We've picked the more rights a parcel of land has, more under whatever the otherwise regulations are, the more important clustering becomes. And so we've looked at what we think are the tough cases, and then again the fly through that shows you from the public road what we're looking at. There we go. And looking at the agricultural land from along the public road.
Driving pretty fast.
Yeah. Well, we just didn't want to keep you any longer than we had to today. Clustering.
Questions on clustering?
Just had one other concept for us to think about. Let's say that farm there was in part of an agricultural resource area, an area greater than 250 acres. I think we should consider not allowing cluster developments if they eat into these very special areas. We don't have a lot of them. We call it an endangered habitat. And the same with forest resource areas and poor forest. I think it would fit, and we should consider, you know, as we move towards the 19th, putting restrictions, further restrictions on where these would be allowed to avoid agricultural resource areas, forest resource areas, and poor forest areas. Because once we take a bite out of that apple, we can't get it back. These particular elements which require a certain amount of acreage, once you take that piece of acreage away, you don't have that resource area anymore, and there's protections attached to those resource areas. I think we need to think about this.
Are you going to propose an amendment?
Yes.
Okay. Other comments or questions? Okay. Let's move on to the next one.
the next program for your consideration, RMP updates and map adjustments. And this again was brought up before you under goals, policies and objectives, and the council did discuss it. What we're bringing to you today in the form of the program does respond to the comments that you made at your last meeting and the request for strict criteria. We've worked the staff and back and forth with our consultants to provide you with what we think is a program that can address this issue. We were also mindful of the comments from the public and so bring to you now this program. It outlines the process for making RMP updates and map adjustments to the numerous components of the regional master plan, including the land use capability map series, because again, some of this being in the update is factual and the other adjustments we'll get to. But it's necessary that you have a process for all of the series to address the series and other regional master plan maps and the supporting database, base data layers, and the tracking of the changes. The update process is based on updated factual information. So that those updates will be on an ongoing basis, and submissions may come from conforming municipalities and counties, as well as non-conforming municipalities. But those are the factual-based ones. The one that where we had much conversation at the last meeting was the map adjustment process. And it's based on policy decisions approved by the Highlands Council during planned conformance or upon the submission of a map adjustment petition. Now, the request must be supported by a demonstration that, one, the adjustment complies with the intent of the regional master plan. Two, it's based on municipal and county planning that results in no net increase in land use intensity from the existing land use capability map series and policies. Three, supports both smart growth and resource preservation. Four, provides no net loss of Highlands resources within the municipality or HUC 14, such that all map adjustment protections are equal to or exceed, on a whole, the protection provided by the land use capability map series and RMP policies. In any case where the map adjustment involves a proposed adjustment to the Highlands Land Use Capability Zone map, designation from the protection or conservation zone to existing community zone, the demonstration must additionally meet. So already the former apply, but in addition, if you're going to change from zone, you have to meet at least five of the following standards, and there are nine standards. Creates a meaningful opportunity for the use of Highlands development credits. Reduces the net impact on Highlands resources. Eliminates substandard wastewater treatment facilities. Contributes to the elimination of net water availability deficits in HUC 14 subwatersheds. Creates meaningful opportunities to provide affordable housing. Creates meaningful employment opportunities for the residents of the Highlands region in terms of the quantity and quality of jobs. Improves the balance of housing and employment in a manner which reduces the length of home to work trips within the Highlands region. Promotes the use of alternative modes of transportation, including transit. And the ninth one is provides uses and facilities which promote eco and or agro-tourism.
I think this is definitely an improvement to have these measures in here. And I think I think you're responsive to comments from last week, and that's great. I have some other thoughts that are just for the council to be thinking about. I asked last week about the preservation area. We can allow this in the preservation area. And I think we should seriously consider prohibiting this these changes in the preservation area. I mean, that's the highest value resources that we have. I think that it's somewhat problematic because of the DEP rules, and I think it would be cleaner and neater not to allow this at all in the preservation area. Also, another policy that I suggested in my edits is that and I like the no net loss approach. I think it's good, and I think we're getting there. But I think we need to do a little more. And I think, you know, one way to do that is to allow this only when we're converting lands from the conservation zone to the community zone. That is not allow the protection zone to go to a lower protected area. So that would be another step down or an added step to not allowing it in the preservation area. And then I'm a little unclear about, I mean, our language, I know we can't be specific because this will be applied when a town comes in for conformance or when an application moves forward, and we have to look at what's on the ground. But I think to give a little more defined protection, we should allow this when there is a one-to-one ratio swap. In other words, if you have a, and my concern is because of the quality of the resource, if you have a high-integrity riparian area, for instance, we know where they are, they're mapped, and that area is going to be eaten into by a map revision, then it should be replaced with a high-integrity riparian area, not something that's amorphously the same. So I think there should be a defined one-to-one ratio for habitat, natural, significant natural areas, all of the various defined features that we have put into the map. And I know it may sound as if it makes it more difficult, but it may not be. And I think that we shouldn't assume it'll be too difficult to do. And it'll be played out on the ground, and it'll be safer, I think, for us to move forward in that way than to start allowing these map adjustments with less definition.
Absolutely. What would that add to what is in this already, if we provide no net loss of highlands resources?
Well, I think, that sounds good, uh-huh. But is it exactly a one-to-one ratio? If you have a high-integrity riparian corridor area, you're going to get a high-integrity riparian corridor area in exchange. And I think it just adds more specificity. And I think that allows them, when you have it written down, it's just clear for the applicant, it's clear for the town, it's clear for us.
I think no net loss is clear to everyone. And I don't know, frankly, and I don't necessarily agree that you need to replace A with A as long as you get the same equivalent benefit from protecting the resource.
Why wouldn't the second A be protected also?
The second
one? The second, what you want to replace it with. I'm not following why that piece of property isn't already protected.
Well, you're moving a map line. So you're taking something, for instance, out of the protection zone where it has more protection and putting it into the conservation zone, say, which has less protection.
But you're applying all of these protective devices.
I'm just saying, I think if we're more specific and make it a one-to-one ratio to make sure that the integrity of that resource is going to be the same, that we're laying the ground rules more clearly. It will be good for towns to know this, good for applicants, good for us.
But you're also making it more restrictive and less likely that this is going to happen.
Not necessarily. I think that's an assumption, and I don't think that's proven.
So you're rather looking to go into the conservation zone and move it back into the protection, an equal amount of acreage or...
And the same value resource. That's what I'm saying. The same value.
I think maybe if you gave an example of what you're talking about, we would all understand.
If you had
where it is a one-to-one, and where it could seem like a comparable, but it really isn't, because that's my concern. You start out entering some elements of subjectivity mm-hmm. to this. And again, it sounds like a small thing, but it's very critical.
Well, let's say you have a
active.
Well, let's say you have a significant natural area that's made up of a rare plant species. If we allow the map to be moved and we lose that, we're not going to get that back unless we require that vegetative community is replaced. And I can see doing that, having this flexibility, if what we're gaining is exactly what we're losing in terms of integrity and value. But I don't think that if we leave it open to say,
we're going to get the same benefit, then who's going to be deciding? Is that plant community the same benefit as replacing it with a different plant community? It's very subjective, and it just adds too much play.
Are you relying on the municipality's professionals to come in and make the case to the council? Well, we think trading off a core forest is no big deal to something or wetland. I can't think of a good example, but they are not. And that's what will happen. The professionals working for the municipality or the developer will come in here and make those arguments, and we're going to be looking at facing a decision on a policy that's not, there's no bright line. I think that's part of what you're saying.
Well, if I could just offer a comment, Mr. Chairman. I think it's important, this is a general observation of which I think this is a part. Regional planning is a process, and it is a process whereby goals, policies, and objectives reflecting the greater than local importance of resources that happen to fall within a local jurisdiction are subject to a ongoing planning process. Candy was Ashman, who I've known for a long time, was here before you all and said, you know, this is the process starts when this plan is adopted. It doesn't end. And I'm firmly convinced that the success of any plan of this kind requires professional, technical advice and reasonable, deliberate public officials in whatever form to make what are ultimately subjective judgments. You cannot treat the system that we're trying to manage is not reducible to numbers. That particular resource that you've mentioned of the endangered plant, my experience is it's very hard to relocate successfully and replace endangered plants. I'm not sure that you'll ever be able to do that. There may be circumstances that accomplish it. You're not going to be able to prescribe those in advance. But you may discover that it's far more important to protect a core forest that's a critical linkage between two programs that, because it was 75 acres or a mapping, some falls in one zone, given the map refinements, that there is a trade-off that makes sense. And I think I'm just asking you to think about the role of this. We're not zoning the highlands. We're creating a management framework for ongoing planning and management. And that is always going to require judgment. And I hope you embrace that, because it's a responsibility that this body will have to follow for you to be successful. I can show you dozens of regional plans that never failed, never succeeded, because there was no assumption of the responsibility for ongoing management. We've done the plan, let it go. Florida did that in the Florida Keys. It didn't work. And so I just encourage you to, you know, Pogo has this wonderful statement about we've met the enemy and he is us. That's true. But we're the only ones who can be responsible custodians and stewards of the resources we're responsible for. I mean, there's just no other solution.
I'd like to make a comment. Sorry, this would sound really corny, but this is what I have tremendous respect for the founding fathers of this country and the Constitution that they put together. And what was so remarkable, they understood human nature. They knew what the real dynamics on the ground were going to be. With all due respect, what you sound good, sounds great, but those of us who have sat on planning boards and see what happens, and not, yes, you know, part of it is the political process and who we elect and who we appoint, I think you're underestimating what the dangers are here, and that we have to get as definitive as we can, and that zoning has to be understood. And this isn't exactly zoning. It's not suggestions. It's rules. It's regulations. And if we fall too short of that, we're not going to be in 10 years where we think we're going to be by doing this. And that's my patriotic speech for today.
Okay. You're going to follow Pogo and the Founding Fathers.
Who decides that these adjustments are made?
You all.
The council.
And it has to be accompanied by a resolution from the municipality, so that there's two controls in there, that it's municipality-driven in the first place, and the request comes from them, and then the second lead is your decision, and you can say no.
So it's a practical matter. If it were a development, they would either read the
planning board and the board of adjustment process, then at the council level, and then here. And having completed all of that, then they would be able to adjust the map.
And the whole concept of regional planning is that there are resources of greater than local value that can't be entrusted just to the municipal perspectives and political constituencies. This is, and really the balance of powers that Debbie referred to in the Constitution is what's missing in land use planning and management. We don't have somebody looking out for the bigger picture.
And also these municipalities will have to either have performance in the state plan or in the Highlands, right?
Correct.
I have a question about the process, the petition process. You mentioned that in here. Let's say this is done during conformance. Will there be a separate public hearing process associated just with the map revision? Because, you know, these things can get lost once. I mean, I know there needs to be a resolution at the municipal level, but a map revision could get lost amongst all the other issues that are going to be addressed by a resolution for conformance. I would suggest that we need to pull it out and have, so we make sure that the public understands in the municipality exactly what the map revision amounts to. Particularly, I mean, I think it's important in both cases, whether it's a site-specific development application or during conformance, but particularly during conformance where there's going to be so many things going on that the revision could get lost. So I'd just like to suggest there be a public hearing process that's attached discreetly to this decision.
We'll work on that and watch on that.
And have we thought about putting a percent cap, perhaps, on how much of the land mass or the acreage in a municipality, you know, so it isn't just sort of all up for grabs?
We haven't thought about that because it's too it's
something to think about.
It's very site specific, you know, these matters, and so I think it's more the no net loss gets to that. Mm-hmm.
To go back to what Debbie said, the founding fathers also put a process in to amend our constitution because they realized that if we couldn't make changes as time went on, that the Constitution won't survive. Our plan won't survive if we don't have an opportunity to make changes that are for the best interest of the plan in the long run. There's going to be times, I just want to get back, if we make it too complicated, it'll work against us because the more complicated you make something, in a sense, the easier you make it to circumvent. If it's straightforward, easy to understand, and allowed to have the openness for people to understand what the process is, then the opportunity for the people to come out and to voice their opinion about what the proposal is a lot better. But if you make it so complicated, it's restrictive enough in my opinion, the way that you've set it up, that it's going to be very difficult for anybody to get to that stage to meet those requirements for us to be able to give it a thumbs up or a thumbs down. But if you make it more complicated, it creates the opportunity to create the confusion so you can achieve what wasn't really meant to be achieved. Simplicity is our best friend in something like this because it gives everybody an opportunity to understand what's going on and to say this wasn't what was intended to be. I think that the process is fine. I think it actually is a little bit too limiting. Because I think we're going to find not only our fear is that things are going to happen that are bad, but what we also haven't thought about is that there's as time goes on down this, we are going to have protected certain natural resources that we may find, like the deer, who we didn't have enough at one time, so we repopulated, and now I could reach out my hand on my way home every night and pet the deer all the way home. We may find that same thing with this species of plant that is protected, and then, you know what, we've got so much of it, but we don't have as much as something else that we need, and it makes sense at that time to change it. We don't need to really protect that as much as we have, but this other natural resource does need to be protected, but for whatever reason it wasn't at the time, because this is going to change over time. And I think that if we make it too restrictive, then we're going to only limit our abilities to do those things. Um, like like with the deer right now. It's taken on a life of its own. And I just think that we should have a little faith in this council and in future councils to follow the law, to follow what's best for the people that they represent at that time and place. And so my recommendation would make is those five extra criteria that we added. I think instead of nine, instead of making it five, I would see to reduce it to three, because I don't know how you'll ever get to five. I mean, it seems they're so different that anything that you try to do, I don't see where you'll get five. I think three is probably a better combination.
That's an interesting point, Mr. Chairman. I too thought that the likelihood of anything achieving these goals is going to be very, very slim. This is going to be tough. And your point about deer and thinking of purple loosestrife, for example, as an invasive species of plant, you know, that people said, it's a beautiful plant, let's just protect it. And now it's so invasive and so everywhere that it's a problem. Those things happen. So I don't know that I would go along with three rather than five. I think this is a very good balance, and it's very, very constricting on the issues that we're concerned about. So I think we're offering a good deal of protection here. But I like your point about the amendments to the Constitution. I support that.
Yeah, I think one thing to keep in mind is that, I mean, that there is a plan, I mean, there's an opportunity and a requirement in the Act that the Council redo the plan or update the plan every
6 years.
So that's something to look forward to. But besides that...
Mr. Chairman, wanted to show. I think we can whittle it all down to the two lines. No net increase in land use and provide no net loss of pounds resources. That says it all to me.
Mr. Chairman, just one last thought. I don't think this is too many. I'd like to add just one more, actually. Again, similar to my comment on the clustering, if we have an area that requires a certain aggregate amount of acreage, such as an agricultural resource area, we should not allow the map lines to be changed unless we're going to get that ag resource area back. And that area is intact. And I think that's a specific example where it really warrants another bullet here to say ag resource areas, forest resource areas, core forest that require, in our definitions, to have a certain amount of acreage not be eaten into by map revisions.
Other comments on this section?
Sorry.
Okay. All right. I think we can move on to this new one. We'll come back to it in 10 days.
You're on.
the next series of our programs, we deliberately put those that had already had much debate and we realized were issues for the council up at the front. The next series of programs is all based on your goals, policies, and objectives. And so I can go through those very quickly. If you stop me, I'll be farewell. The first two are land preservation, agricultural management, and sustainability. They are similar. But starting with land preservation, we all know that the Act's mandate to protect and enhance the ecosystem function, protect the drinking water systems, and preserve natural and recreational lands. So this goes to this particular program. It starts with work that we have done, which is the identification of critical lands already preserved. You do have a map, and that has been updated as well since the 2006 iteration. The establishment of land preservation and priorities and special areas. Again, this work has been done by and updated by staff. Implementation of strategies for land stewardship by maximising current land stewardship funding programmes. An analysis has been done by staff on existing funding programmes so that we can maximise and in terms of our education and outreach make sure that we get word out to landowners, etc. And as we move forward on preservation that we can use these funds for stewardship. establishment of alternative and new land preservation programs and stewardship programs, and in particular here we've been looking at forestry issues, cognizant of Green Acres requirement for access, but looking to the future for stewardship and acquisition of these lands, because they are very critical from the Highlands perspective. Development of open space conservation design standards. This gets to a lot of what we've already talked about, to make sure that we do protect those open spaces. And identification of willing sellers. A lot of this, again, is going to be in the form of education and outreach. Some has already been done by the council, but we need to do more work in this area. The Highlands Council will establish a technical assistance programme for land preservation and stewardship, and will explore, in addition to existing funding sources, securing other stable, dedicated sources of funding. And these are matters that you've certainly talked to before, but we wanted to make sure that it's up front in the programme. The Reserve Fund to capitalise the Highlands TDR programme, the Highlands Water User Fee, a surcharge on public water supply systems rates that use Highlands waters, and also continuation of the dual appraisal method isn't in this programme, but is something, again, that you have spoken to and made your will known to legislators.
I appreciate the reference to the user fee rather than the alternative method of identifying that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Because, you know, we've talked about that a lot, and I think that's a more appropriate way to do this. It's more acceptable, more understandable, and more consistent with the way we normally do things. To call it something else, which is the case some of those who are opposed to it, I think, is doing a disservice to the issue.
Thank you. The Agricultural Management and Sustainability Programme. I'm sorry.
I've got a question on the back here to land preservation. One of the requirements of the Act is that we identify lands that we're going to target for conservation as a result of this whole resource assessment. I don't see that. Is it here, and I've missed it, and I'm trying to wrap our arms around all these documents we've had presented to us?
We are mapping the priorities and the special areas. That particular list is a confidential list that is to be sent to Green Acres and SADC. And I'm looking to Tom to confirm that.
Yeah, but we did update the same tool we used in the last iteration of the plan, the conservation priority area, for both open space purposes for Green Acres and a priority process for SADC purchases through a farmland preservation program.
But I thought we were going to go another step somehow.
What I was referring to is the Act does provide a mechanism for us to send both DEP, Green Acres, and SADC a confidential list by a lot more basis. But we do have a tool that from a spatial analysis, can also map priority areas.
So for meeting the Act's requirement that we identify no growth areas, that's phrase the Act?
Yeah, it's referred to as special, we're using it as special areas in this program.
So I got confused. So what the draft plan and final plan will say about, in order to meet that requirement of the Act, is what? I understand the confidential list and why that's confidential.
Right. But the conservation priority tool, both for Green Acres and SADC, is a map that you've seen before. We've updated. That's the tool to get at that list.
Agricultural management and sustainability. Again, preservation of farmland and promotion of agriculture in the Highlands region are two essential objectives of the Act. Again, it's a similar process as for the land preservation. First, the initial was the identification of agricultural lands, the establishment of agricultural preservation priorities, and then the implementation of strategies for agriculture preservation by maximising current agricultural preservation and stewardship funding programs. Establishment of alternative or new agricultural preservation and stewardship sustainability programs. Establishing incentives for voluntary impervious cover limitations on agricultural lands. We do call out in the program the use of federal farm bill programs such as FRPP, the Farm and Ranch Land Protection Program, when working with willing landowners that does bring an incentive, sorry, an impervious cover limit. Development of open space, conservation design standards, similar to, again, to the discussion, to the previous program and the discussion that we had earlier. Additional land use opportunities. We do speak to the opportunities on ag lands for use of those lands, such as B&Bs and things of that nature that enhance agricultural viability. Again, identification of willing sellers. Establishment of a farmland preservation and stewardship technical assistance program. Again, we work with other state agencies. We're already working with State Agricultural Development Committee on issues such as that, NRCS and other groups. Identification of sub-watersheds with elevated nitrate levels and development of management plans for those areas. Again, we're talking to incentivize programs here to establish BMPs to address those kind of issues.
I didn't see it in here. I know I saw it somewhere, a right to farm. I don't know whether it belongs here or under plan performance, but I think that at a bare minimum, the municipalities, as they go through the performance process, should have an approved right to farm ordinance accepted by the local CATV, because that gives you some, it allows for sustainability of agriculture, and also gives you some management tools. And it's very important that you preserve farmers as well as farming. Otherwise, they go away. And then I have another comment about the, we've talked about this ratio of woodland to farmland. And it's true that they have the ratio issue at the state level, but in the County of Morris, for example, the CADB has its own county funds, and they're able to determine that ratio in a different manner, whether they will or not. So I think it's important that the council reach out to the CADBs the same way they do with the SADC and talk about those issues for sustainable forests and stewardship programs, because that's part of the hierarchy that they use when they identify farms for preservation. So to ignore them, I think, is a mistake. There is funding there, and we may be able to get some bigger bang for our buck by integrating them in our process.
Right, and we do call out the CADBs in this, and you're quite correct. We're also very aware that there are good programs out there that we should borrow from and incorporate. So when we talk about our technical guidelines, we are talking about not reinventing the wheel, but using what's already available.
Well, one of the things, if you talk about technical assistance to a farmer, if you go out and you help them make that presentation for preservation and show the interrelationship between the woodland management area and the farm, and then you go to the CADB, there'd be a better chance that they would be used county funds, for example, maybe not state funds, to preserve that particular farm, or municipal funds.
In connection with Mr. Carver's point, policy 3.4.5, page 3, the last policy, refers to restricting the amount of impervious surface and agriculture impervious cover.
Jack, could you
just that flies in the face of the State Ag Board's latest recommendation for impervious cover on a resort farm. I think that needs to be reconciled. You know what I'm referring to?
3.4.5 on page 3. 3.4.5,
the last policy at the top of page 3.
This is focused on actually setting up an incentive program as opposed to a mandatory change to the mandatory portions of the program. So it's in addition to what would be under the SADC program.
That's what concerns me, actually, because the SADC program offers more flexibility.
Well, we actually said that we would work with the SADC on this matter to create the incentive, so it would require that kind of coordination between.
Suggesting a reconciliation.
Yes. So so we were. That's why we called out that we would work with them to achieve that. So it requires both sides agreeing.
Yes, but to put a specific impervious cover number in here,
that actually comes right from the Act.
Yeah.
This provision comes directly from the Act. Yeah.
What is the
number? State
Jack, what is the number? What is the number?
The state number now? I think it's 30%.
What is it? Did you know, honey? Okay.
Is it?
I'm sorry, what's the question?
It's State Agriculture Development Committee has recommended 30% impervious cover.
Equine operations,
right. But that would include a preserved farm that is used for equine operations. So I think the numbers have to be reconciled between the state and what we're proposing here.
Right, I think the policy 3.4
and
5 called out was actually a policy that was in the
Commerce
Act.
That's correct.
Yes, that, that's
yeah.
what I hear.
Incentive program.
Right, so what prevails here?
Well, this is a voluntary incentive program to say if a constant land 5% impervious, there would be a incentive program established to encourage that. Obviously, if it's an equine operation that has encouraged that, they wouldn't be eligible.
Yeah, so that's kind of my point, that we are limiting eligibility by doing that. I would like to see more preservation rather than less preservation.
Well, in this case, Mr. Schreier, the farmer would have the opportunity to work through the regular program and have that ability, but we would offer incentives working with SADC for willing landowners to commit to the impervious cover restriction. So it would require them, so either way, they could still go through the regular program. This is, and it's similar to using the FRPP program, which has been used on Highlands Farms. The farmer had the choice. They could go the regular route, or they could take on the impervious cover limits that are part of that FRPP program. And we worked with the State Agricultural Development Committee in using those on those particular farms as well.
I do understand.
Yeah.
I do.
But we're not limited in the sense that a farmer has a choice here. And if they work, but what we want to do is create the program with the incentive so that we can encourage them to take on the impervious cover limits.
I do understand. What I'm suggesting is that if we didn't make it so small, the number for impervious cover, that we would incentivize more farmers.
Right.
That's all I'm saying.
Mr. Chairman,
is the number in the act?
Yes, the number is in the act.
Question on policy 3.4.1. What are we talking about in terms of alternative and innovative wastewater treatment systems? I had suggested an edit that says providing they meet the minimum requirements of NJAC 7:9A. That is what we're thinking, right? We're not talking about making it less strict than the state code.
No, the state codes are by definition minimum standards for anything that would happen here.
Okay, so just want to make sure.
Yeah.
Has Kurt had a chance? Did he submit any comments? No, Kurt and I did speak before him, but he hasn't submitted comments on this. The next program is Forest Resource Management and Sustainability. Again, the forests provide essential ecosystem functions, including surface water filtration. They serve as habitat for plants and animals, and in addition, when managed for sustainable use, they can be a source of renewable wood products as well as alternative forest products. Forest sustainability. For long-term sustainability of the forest resource in the Highlands, there must be proactive management of deer populations, non-native invasive species, and reductions in the rate of forest fragmentation. The council will work to develop a model municipal tree ordinance, and we do have many examples of this from municipalities and from programs such as the Hunterdon County Toolbox, Environmental Toolbox. We develop community forestry plans for Highlands municipalities, developing forest conservation and mitigation plans, developing forest stewardship plans for preserved lands, and the last element of this is that to have a green or third-party certification for Highlands forest products to market those.
What types of proactive plans for deer management?
I actually thought we'd probably use you as a resource for that. I know your background in those kinds of management.
I mean, how many are there?
How many deer?
No. How many different kinds?
I thought you were asking deer.
Not even
question, she had the answer to that.
Well, I can make one up. This is you know, working into the future. This is the kind of thing we want to work on.
I had a question on one thing. We were talking about the municipal tree ordinance. I know that the forest management activities are exempt, but can we require them to follow our forest conservation plans that we talk about developing here, or is that a layer that can't be?
I turned to Tom on that to make sure that we're.
I mean, the exemption is the exemption.
Okay, so there's nothing we can do except maybe incentivize
well,
or something.
Like other suggestions, like the extension of the GSBT expiration, I think this council should and we plan to have a section where we make legislative suggestions to improve the Highlands Act.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
You're expecting that to be in the draft plan?
It already is in some cases.
There's some, yeah,
yes.
Examples,
but yes, but if that's one we want to identify, we can certainly add it.
You wouldn't call it the Highlands Improvement Act.
I would suggest not putting in any legislative changes until we get to adopting a plan and then see what, rather than doing a draft. But
I think by the time March comes around, if that's the direction the council takes, there'll be additions to.
Right.
I had one other suggestion under the developed forest conservation mitigation plans. Which is on page 3, for requirements under number 2, that it says that if the developer clears 1 acre of forest, they can replant an acre in the proximate area. I would suggest we make that a little more specific and say if it's in a forest resource area, for instance, it should be within that same forest resource area, again, just so we're not eating into and doing away with the aggregate acreage that makes up a forest resource area. Also, core forest. There are certain, irreplaceable features of the core forest that we eat into and very difficult to replace on a swap. So I think in terms of forest resource areas, we should be very careful about this and only allow it if they can actually replant the acre of similar trees within that forest resource area. We could also add HUC 14, another thing to think about, because that, you know, one of the advantages that we know from the forest cover is the water quality and the hydrologic advantages of that forest. So we could also consider it attaching to HUC 14 as well. Sort of like when we are allowing, wetlands mitigation or anything, that it be within the same wetlands. Same idea here, that when you replace it, it be within the same forest resource area or HUC 14 and HUC 14.
Could we ask for a bonus?
That's
another
way to go.
Ask for a bonus if they moved away from the area?
Well, I think that's fine if you're going to consider moving, you know, just a certain distance. But I think in terms of providing the same environmental benefit, if you're eating away at the forest resource area, which we know has a defined benefit and has to have a certain amount of acreage in order to be mapped that way, we're really shooting ourselves in the foot if we're taking away from that.
One thing I would clarify, the forest resource area, there's basically one forest resource area. It's a very large swath of the highlands. Defining it more narrowly, such as sub-watershed, or such as putting priority on adding to core forest is probably more getting to the point that you're trying to make.
Sounds good. Another way to do it. Okay.
I mean, I think it's important that we not lose sight of that we're looking at the highlands as a region, and if someone can show convince the council that there's a net benefit to the region, that's a good thing. And if it's moving from one, if it's not exactly in the same site, but we can discuss it in the context of amendments.
Okay.
The next program is the program on critical habitat. Section of habitats that are critical to maintaining the biodiversity, contributes to the protection of rare, threatened, or endangered plant and animal species in the Highland region. It's a mandate of the Act. This program speaks to the development of a municipal conservation and management overlay district ordinance, development of critical habitat conservation and management guidance, ensuring implementation of habitat conservation and management, and implementation of critical habitat conservation and management projects. And this is work we would anticipate working very closely with DEP as well to develop these. The next program is water quality restoration, and it's in response to the Act's call for protection, enhancement and restoration of the region's water. The first issue is to look and work on water quality assessment throughout the region. The second is to work, coordinate efforts with New Jersey Department of Environmental Protection regarding their responsibility in the development and implementation of total maximum daily loads, TMDLs, and incorporating appropriate management measures into the RMP for TMDL implementation. So that's something we want to put forth to you and say that that's something we would work with NJDEP to do. Watershed restoration plans to identify key HUC 14 sub-watersheds and either directly or in cooperation with other affected interests develop watershed restoration plans for approval by DEP and incorporation as appropriate into the RMP or its programs. To develop those groundwater restoration plans as well, it's something else that the Highlands Council should be doing. And implementation of water quality restoration projects, as they refer to agricultural BMPs, stormwater management plans, stream bank and riparian restoration, wildlife, septic system management, and contaminated site remediation. And finally, the last part of that program is education and outreach on all issues pertaining to water quality restoration.
I had a comment. I think we could put an extra policy here under the RMP policies and objectives addressed on page 2. Again, to just carry over from our other discussions, to track new sources of nitrates from on-site septic systems and other land use related sources. I know that this is dependent on, you know, whether we have the funds to do this kind of monitoring, but I think it's a key issue, and we should consider this as part of our water quality analysis efforts. Also, other pollutant inputs from septic systems and development projects, non-point source as well as point source. I think that would provide me with some comfort, and I think it would give us, you know, a little better idea of how over time developments which are going to be introducing pollutants are actually affecting the water quality in the streams.
You think track those?
Track, right. And then under water quality assessment, we had discussed in the past, I think I brought this up last week, a question about are we, and I also brought it up under our science agenda, which I guess we're going to discuss later, about assessing the assimilative capacity of streams. And I don't know if you addressed that in the later program, but we had talked about this early on and actually had quite a long discussion about this at former council meetings when we were preparing a draft, last year's draft. And that is that, you know, there has been a tremendous amount of wastewater NPDES permits issued by DEP, and I think we don't have a handle on whether or not the streams can really assimilate the waste that they're already that they're already receiving, and I think that, you know, knowing the answer to that will also help us to understand what, even though we're looking at TMDLs, and I understand that, but what streams are at risk in terms of, you know, perhaps being degraded because we don't have this information on the assimilative capacity of the streams to process what we're already putting into them or plan to put into them as we move forward. So I don't know how that got lost. I mean, I know it was actually a paragraph or two in the former draft. So can you just address this concept?
In response to your comments on assessment, tracking, and monitoring, to a certain degree, we have addressed those in the ongoing science agenda, but not to the specific level that you're asking in terms of not site specific in terms of septic, mainly because I don't know that we have the ability to do it to that level, nor the funding. But we do intend on having a tracking system for water and wastewater and for stream integrity. But I've asked Dan to be sort of more fine-tuned in the response. But we have talked about our ongoing work and contracts with USGS to do some of this monitoring work. But we are limited to our ability within our RMP, budget.
But I think the tracking and modeling and the stream integrity all needs to be evaluated, not on a project basis, but on a systems basis, mm-hmm. and I think that's what the science agenda does. And in fact, you may not want to model a new development because you may not see effects for 10 years. It may be more appropriate to model a comparable development that took place 10 years ago to see what the long-term effects are. So I think the science agenda really does respond to those concerns.
One thing that I would suggest is at the very top of page 3, where we talk about inventorying where surface water quality is impaired, it's perfectly legitimate to put is impaired or is at risk of impairment, because just looking through the list of things that we're talking about here, that idea of risk analysis does not come out, and I think that's very appropriate.
I think that's a very good suggestion, and it could replace the other bullet comment that I added in my edits. As long as, you know, then we understand what we're talking about. We're talking about taking a look at those streams that are at risk because they may not have the similar capacity to handle the pollution that's already being produced.
General, I just have a general question. Since you were involved in the creation and development of the Pinelands Plan, does the Pinelands Plan address issues that we're addressing with the kind of specificity that we are including in our RMP? Or is it more general because it's a more cohesive area rather than the 800,000 acres that we're talking about here?
I think it's hard. In some ways, it's hard to generalize. In some ways, the Pinelands Plan was very specific because their model was the statute gave them authority over the region and then authorized them to certify municipal programs and then to redelegate the authority. So they had to have specific enough standards to implement at the outset until municipal conformance occurred. Here, we don't have that kind of direct authority. And I think that what we've tried to do is strike an appropriate balance between specificity. We've, at least the consultant team and staff, have tried to provide as much specificity as we can as a framework for the municipal undertakings. But in some areas, the diversity of circumstances is so great that we believe we have to be a little more general specification of how the framework for conformance. And I hope we're striking a fair balance, but there's we've talked about it in a number of areas where the more specific you are, the less opportunity for interaction and sound planning. On the other hand, there are certain basic minimums we've got to make sure are achieved or you won't achieve the objectives of the Act. So unfortunately, I would say that the comparison is hard to make on a specificity basis because of the Pinelands' initial responsibility as custodian of all permitting until a municipal conformance took place.
Next program is the creation of a Highlands Smart Growth Manual. Again, you know, we'll be drawing from what's already available, but working to address the following issues: location efficiency, resource efficiency, green building technology, including water conservation and energy efficiency, energy efficient practices, innovative building practices and techniques, site layout and design techniques, cluster lot averaging and conservation development techniques, promoting a better jobs to housing balance, redevelopment and revitalization techniques, addressing affordable housing and community facilities, connecting transportation, transit, and land use planning, and a list of state and national smart growth publications and resources. Again, having developed this manual, the Council will provide technical and planning assistance and planning grants. And this manual is to promote the smart growth principles that are called out in the Act and would be used in working with communities for during conformance.
So the manual would be prepared coincident with or soon after plan adoption?
We're going to start all of these manuals and guidance documents will be started after you release the draft plan, but they would not be completed by not all of them by the time of adoption. It'd be ongoing work.
And it would be and adopted piecemeal approved.
Approved, yes.
By the council.
Yes.
As they're completed.
But I would just this is sort of a personal privilege. I hope the council will, over time, avoid a mistake that some agencies have made, is they prepare a manual and then let it remain as static. And when you prepare the manual, you ought to, in my judgment, have an ongoing process to incorporate the lessons learned into that manual, because nothing's a better manual than the experience you have under the Act, or the plan when it's adopted and implemented.
The next program is on sustainable regional economy. The Act encourages agricultural viability, redevelopment, smart growth strategies, improved land use efficiency, transit-oriented development, and shared services. The Council will conduct research with respect to existing and new economic development initiatives that can help promote and support the long-term integrity of the region. The Economic Tracking Programme will monitor and evaluate the health of the Highlands economy for a set of regionally available economic indicators. The fiscal monitoring component of the programme includes the cash flow timetable tracking mandated by the Highlands Act and the monitoring and tracking of municipal fiscal performance in support of conformance activities and regional shared service opportunities. And the programme will specifically focus on tourism, which would be agritourism and ecotourism, agricultural vitality and economic efficiency of land use. Transportation, safety and mobility. Again, the Act states that a primary goal is to promote a sound and balanced transportation system consistent with smart growth strategies and principles which preserve mobility. The first element of this is linking the transportation and land use. In working with towns during plan conformance, we would work with circulation plans. We would evaluate the local transit scores. We've been working with NJ Transit on this element. They have a score program which they've shared with us, which we would use. Parking studies, evaluate and make recommendations on RSIS, and evaluate and make recommendations on transit. And RSIS are the residential site improvement standards. Regional transportation safety and pedestrian security, working with DOT, who's done a lot of work in this area, but promoting transportation safety in coordination with other state agencies, in particular them. Mobility of agriculture and freight access, coordinating safe travel routes for farmers with local governments and state agencies. Again, much of this work would take place during conformance, and coordinating with NJDOT on their new comprehensive statewide freight plan. Transportation and tourism economy would be an element of the programme. Overview of transportation project reviews and roadway capacity monitoring. Programme on housing and community facilities. The plan seeks to address a full range of housing needs for the region within the context of resource protection needs and sustainable development patterns. The first element is housing affordability, municipal compliance with COA, Highlands build-out model, which would be done, of course, after adoption of the... would start immediately after release of the plan, but it has to be done in accordance with the land use capability zone map. Indicators as an assessment tool, partnerships for affordable housing and technical assistance and planning. Agricultural workers housing, a program and an element that would seek to address seasonal and non-seasonal family and farm worker housing. Housing and community facilities, evaluation of the jobs to housing balance, transit enhancement, educational facilities and recreation programs, opportunities for maximizing shared services and infrastructure investment. Smart growth and housing, appropriate development, redevelopment, economic growth, and the Transfer Development Rights Program, focusing on existing infrastructure and compact forms of development. Green and energy efficient facilities, and housing and employment, coordinating with state agencies on initiatives such as transit villages, the Main Street programs in OSG, GCA, and EDA and HMFA, that's the Economic Development Authority and Housing and Mortgage Financing Authority, working with them on their assistance programs. The local participation component. The following, this is to maintain the practices that you've already established, already used, and moving forward that we would continue to do these things. Partnership program, the technical advisory committees that you used in the past, so in some of the programs we speak to using them again on an as-needed basis, and the network that you use, which is really the web-based availability of information. Our regular public meetings and presentations, individual outreach and constituent services. I usually bring you up to date on those in the reports, the executive director reports, but there's a lot of that that goes on a daily basis within the office. Special stakeholder events, particularly as we move forward, and this gets to a lot of the education outreach that was mentioned in other programs. Web access and data sharing. We will be going back through our website and making sure that we update and make more materials available. And training and education for municipal officials and staff. This will be very important as we move into the conformance component to work with the municipal officials and their staff. And in terms, this goes to Charlie's comment really as well on it assists us as well in making sure that our documents are reflective of lessons learned in working with those municipalities. So it's sort of a two-way street. Master plan monitoring program. The implementation of the monitoring program is necessary to ensure the vision of long-term sustainability in the Highlands region and of course, to chart our progress. Indicators relating to environmental, social and economic health will be used to document changes in the Highlands region. Indicators will be chosen based upon the usefulness of information they communicate and the data availability throughout the region over time. And they may be either quantitative or qualitative, depending on the parameter to be measured. The monitoring review report will track changes to the indicators and report on Highlands milestones achieved and not achieved. Project review process. The purpose of this program is to establish administrative and procedural standards to facilitate accurate, comprehensive and timely reviews of applications submitted to the Highlands Council. We've had an opportunity to do a lot of work in this area, working on some pilot projects that have come in to the Council. Setting forth administrative procedures, standard operating procedures regarding all project applications received. Technical review procedures to establish detailed technical review procedures, again, for all project categories, and council review determinations, set forth the process for those council determinations.
So would this be the same, the section that would apply to the review of municipal and county finance?
No.
Where is that?
That's the in your conformance. Okay. This is just for those projects that we review.
Okay.
The next program speaks to federal, state, and regional agency coordination. The Highlands Act requires this coordination and consistency component, which details the way in which local, state, and federal programs and policies may best be coordinated to promote the goals, purposes, policies, and provisions of the Regional Master Plan. Obviously, we've been working with a lot of the agencies to date, and we hope to continue that and set forth different opportunities and to do that into the future. One would be the creation of interagency committees. We've spoken of this again in some of the programs. An example that comes to mind is following the example of Office of Smart Growth Brit, the Brownfields Redevelopment Interagency Team. These would be teams that we pull together, again on an as-needed basis, to facilitate that kind of coordination and helping us work with our conforming municipalities and in terms of project review as well. Coordination with regional agencies, such as we do, and state agencies. Examples, again, the county planning board meetings, the county planners meetings that we have. That's the kind of coordination that we seek to continue. And working with state agencies, again, on an as-needed basis, pulling groups together to work on specific issues. Specific coordination with the State Planning Commission, our ongoing work with the MOU, which has now, as you know, is going before the State Planning Commission and will be brought before you as well. It's gone through the committee process. Specific coordination with regional, county, and municipal planning agencies, again, as needed, during performance and project review. The next program speaks somewhat to some of the issues that Tracy brought to your attention earlier in this meeting. And this is a water resources science agenda moving forward, implementing the goals, policies and objectives of the Regional Master Plan require programs to guide the ongoing research agenda after the adoption of the RMP. And many of these components have already been started. Groundwater capacity estimates and groundwater availability thresholds, protection of downstream water source and safe yields, expand the ambient biological monitoring network in the Highlands region, digital terrain modelling and hydrologic unit determinations, water quality, water and wastewater tracking, water and wastewater use data, regional stream integrity model, groundwater quality management, and models for establishing septic density.
And Mr. Chairman, I would like to say again that I think that we need to be looking at and tracking the pollutant loads from septic systems, particularly the nitrates and also other pollutants. And I see what you're saying here, Eileen, at policy 2451 says to monitor and assess nitrate-related impacts. But I would suggest that we should have a specific program for well monitoring for wells in proximity to new projects that go in, and also for the continuation of land use practices that may contribute nitrates. And I think this is really important because we're putting so much faith into the nitrate dilution model that we're using. So I would like to reiterate that we do that. Also, a similar capacity. What is the policy or the program in here that addresses that? Would you say the ability of streams to assimilate the pollutants?
I'm turning to Dan.
The water quality component is where that would come out, and then it cross-references back to the water quality restoration program. So if we make those changes that we were talking about in that program, then they wind up flowing through to this.
It would be part of our science agenda. It would define what we mean by that, the science agenda, you're
saying? The notion is that every one of these is going to wind up needing a work plan that will come back to the council because there's money that's going to be attached to it. And so at that point, we get down to the details. But basically, the idea is to have those two programs, the water quality restoration program and the water science agenda, work in tandem. And so if we address it in one place, we're addressing it at both.
Okay, so we'll be fleshing that out as we move forward with the science agenda. I think that's very good. There was also in the D'Amico Associates letter, he had brought up the issue of having a better method to analyze groundwater availability as one of the projects that he thought would be important moving forward in terms of our science agenda. Where is that addressed, or is that addressed in here?
Well, there are two different places where that would get addressed. One is under groundwater capacity estimates and groundwater availability thresholds, because that gets into
where
the whole issue.
From
the page two.
Okay.
That gets into the whole issue of how much water is actually there. And then it also ties in on page five to the models for establishing septic system density, because, as you know, the issue of recharge and water availability is directly tied to septic system density analysis. So it really winds up coming in as an issue of consideration in both of those agendas.
It sounded to me, though, that you were on page five, where that's discussed, it's only talking about doing the USGS project, not the project that was suggested in the D'Amico and Associates letter, which is a characterization of the water that contributes to base flow in the streams in order to try to get a better handle on what areas are recharging and, you know, how old that water is, and is there more of it on slopes, all of that, which will give us a better idea of where groundwater is actually available to dilute pollutants in the aquifer system.
And that's more directly page two, but it has implications for page five. Because if you change your values on recharge, then you have changed your values with regard to system density. So the two are connected. But the critical issue of how much water is available is a page two issue.
Okay, so where you say there the groundwater availability analysis, you're including that suggested study.
We're going to look at a number of different possibilities, because there is no hard and fast, firm sense in the scientific community as to the best way to do this.
Mm-hmm.
So we really need to cast a broader net and then figure out what's going to work for us.
Mm-hmm. Okay. As long as you're including it. Thank you.
Other comments on this session?
Okay.
Great.
The final program is plan performance. Plan performance is the process to align municipal and county plans, regulations, and programs with the goals, requirements, and provisions of the regional master plan. The Highlands Council will track the progress of the municipality or county in meeting that schedule and monitor development reviews and capital projects for compliance with the conformance approval. We have a draft plan performance guidelines. We will work on planning and technical assistance with communities, procedures for municipal and county plan conformance, Highlands Council review, evaluation and decision process, a grants program, and I just want to draw your attention to the fact that the grants program calls out the opportunity for communities to have a grant that will assist them in working with their professionals to assess the impact of the plan in their particular municipalities so that they can then consider conformance with that information. And then the grants speak to the actual conformance process and beyond that as well, to different things like smart growth opportunities, those kind of opportunities for grants, and some that you've done already working with agriculture. And the final component would be a compliance component, because we need to track the record and make sure that towns that conform stay in compliance and work with them to assist that, that may be so.
Within what time frame must the letter of intent, after the analysis is done, be submitted to the Highlands Council, letter of intent to perform?
The Act says that in 9 to 15 months after the adoption of the Act, we have to do work with the towns and counties that are mandated for conformance for those areas.
Well, they have to come into conformance within 9 to 15 months.
Correct. We don't have a time on the letter of intent.
The draft guidelines from last year had, as I recall,
30 days, but I'll have to double check.
30 days?
For the preservation.
Right. 30 days from what to what?
From adoption of the plan.
If they have to give us a letter of intent.
Right. I have to double check it, but we had a date in the guidelines.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We have, to go back to the beginning, we have the minutes from our meeting last Thursday. Second from Dennis. Are there any comments or corrections for the minutes? All those in favor?
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Abstentions?
Abstain.
Okay. Before we get to public comments, any questions from council members about the process from here to November 19th?
I have another follow-up from the last meeting. I had asked a question about criteria for the model for the land use capability map or lands map. And I went back, I could not find a list, and I had nothing. Do you remember I asked for a comparison of what criteria? Because it went from 31 criteria to whatever. I haven't seen it. The only thing I could find was that, which was, and how many is it now? 13?
You're talking about the 51.
51.
51 to, come on, way off. 51 to what?
21.
To 21. Okay. I could pour through all of this and find it, but can I get
it? I apologize, Debbie. I handed it out at that meeting,
okay,
and I did not send
say.
It to you.
I didn't. So. Today. I want to get a copy of that.
Absolutely.
What,
can I get a copy of that, too?
I thought I gave you a copy.
Yeah,
here
took it back from me too.
Thanks.
You could email it. I mean, it's I think I had in my mind.
No, absolutely.
I was thinking, looking for an email, and it dawned on me like last night. So I that's why.
The numbers are actually in the minutes that we handed out to you, but the chart is much easier to read. So I'll send
and
you
one
the chart.
One of the things I noticed is that stream protection. What I did find, and going back to all my emails, stream protection was a criteria that was eliminated. And I've heard about the simplification and the redundancy, but I'm troubled by that because protection of streams is an integral part of the Water Planning Protection Act. And that's one issue that I'm having difficulty feeling comfortable with. And the other thing is, we as a council, we had a while ago identified that was an objective, that was something that was going to be a criteria. It's been eliminated from the model. And, you know, these aren't edits. These are like substantive changes in policy direction that seem to be happening in this process that aren't being made clear. And I just want to express that that's a discomfort I have with this, that we're all trying to meet a deadline. We understand that. But some of these are critical. So I want to look real closely at that list. That's just one thing that I saw, and maybe talk about some more in the future because I haven't done the real.
Well, let's talk about that one now. The stream corridors are still in the plan.
Yes, and they're captured in the lands model. Well, there's separate mapping, but in the we're speaking to the land use capability zone map, and they are captured in that in riparian corridors. But what we made sure in this process was we didn't lose protection of those critical areas. We simplified the model to avoid duplication. They were captured under other indicators. And I think that if you look to the map and to the past, where the existing community was added to was with the addition of the transportation indicators and capturing, as Charlie put it earlier, realities that exist on the ground. It wasn't that lands that should be protected moved over. It was existing realities and those transportation indicators.
If I could also, just to add one point in here, the issue of streams and the stream buffers gets applied at the project review level and would be applied through conforming municipalities at the project review level. And so that does not go away. That never goes away. What we found, though, was when we looked back at the prior land use capability map, the question of does the existence of streams, all types of streams, drive the zone in one way or the other, the answer was no. But what did drive the land use zone in one way or the other was the riparian areas in high quality riparian watersheds. And so that's the parameter that wound up being used in the new land use capability map. So we did include the full riparian area of those streams that had high-quality riparian areas as a protection zone indicator. And that's really something that did drive very, very definitely toward the protection zone.
So what kind of stream corridors were eliminated then?
I would never say that any were eliminated. There were some that drove the use of the designation of the zone, and there are others that would be addressed during project-specific site plan review. So we never lose any of our streams or their corridors. What we did is that some of them were used in driving the designation of protection zone, and others, like the ones that would go through the middle of an existing urban center, would not. You would not have a protection zone going through the middle of Morristown.
But we did capture those kind of issues in our constrained zones, many of those issues that were not picked up in the last iteration, the last land use capability, well, the last zone map. They were picked up in this way, so we got to a further refinement, and then things like the Lake Community subzone. So we further refined and captured, and when I give you the analysis from the change from one to the other, you'll see that there's 10% greater areas protected that need this protection than there were in the previous map.
Please email that to me, because I just realized I'm really keeping most of this electronically.
Well, absolutely.
I don't have enough room in my house for paper.
I'll send it to you electronically.
Thank you. And I think there's one of these in Hackettstown. I'm trying to think of a specific example. Is there somebody? I think there's one, and not to pick on Hackettstown, but I'm more familiar with Hackettstown than some other towns. What does this mean, then? What does this mean for them from the old draft to the new draft?
The zones primarily drive density of land use and the general layout of land use. Within each zone, and for many of the resource policies, it's irrelevant to zone, you still wind up protecting the stream buffer, the wetlands buffer, the steep slopes, all of these kinds of features. There are protections regardless of which zone you're in. And so you can be in an existing community zone, and if there's a stream buffer that is currently not developed and it's 300 feet, then it's a 300-foot stream buffer, and it doesn't really matter what zone you're in. So that's the distinction that you would make, is that there are site constraints that apply all over the place. There are regional capacity constraints that apply by zone.
None of the original indicators have been lost. They'll all be used in joint performance and site-specific reviews.
Okay, thank you. Turn to public comments. How many people would like to speak? Yeah. Is there anybody here who has not addressed the council before? Okay. So put your hand back up so I can speak.
Julia.
Julia Summers, New Jersey Highlands Coalition. I spent 6 years of my life trying to protect an area where the state DEP insisted it had absolutely put every kind of protection to prevent further extension of the sewer service area. Those were very difficult years. We may have been successful, I don't know. There is no final end to that saga at this point. And with all due respect to those politicians here, it was politics that kept us at it. I just don't know how you keep politics out of the extension of sewer lines unless you have very specific things that say that you will not you have to put some bright line things in for extension of sewer lines. And that for me, that was a real cautionary tale for what you're doing. And I recognize flexibility and all these sort of things can be valuable, but that was a severe cautionary tale that an agency that felt that it had done everything that needed to be done to protect a very environmentally sensitive area still had not. So I would like to talk about just Tracy's position on clusters. I heard all of your discussion here, but one of the things that seems to be lost is we're not talking about in ag areas where we would be introducing the potential for cluster. We're not talking about either agriculture or cluster. We're now talking about both agriculture and cluster. We are increasing nitrates. There's just no way you can get around that. So I think there have to be areas that you have, I would ask that there should be areas that you should simply make a policy that cluster is not appropriate. Forested areas, high-value agricultural areas should be amongst them. Where does that leave? You know, the areas of ag that are not high-value agricultural areas. With all due respect to your consultants, it was very concerning seeing these real-life proposals for cluster that were all being put in forested areas where the trees were being cut down. I'm not quite sure that that is what you're trying to do. And then my last question is, the D'Amico letter, when will that become public?
That D'Amico letter's fine. Let's get that to you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Was that emailed to us alone?
It was in the last packet.
It was in the packet last week.
But last week.
It was the last one or the one before.
Last week. Okay. We asked last week, but we were told it was still deliberative. Mm-hmm.
Oh. Any other comments?
Yes.
Wilma Fry, New Jersey Conservation Foundation. Starting at the first issue, the land use capability map, the zone map, is that one, I believe. What I see is, I do not see any distinction on that map made between the preservation and the planning area. Am I correct? And I don't see that?
There's a line there.
Mm-hmm. Oh, there's a line. Okay, well, I felt that the last map, where it was very clear by the color gradation, what was in preservation and what was in planning, I think that's fairly important. And I think that, you know, as a matter of graphics, you know, the preservation area has its standards, and I think that it's really important that that come through in the land use capability map. I have some comments about the clustering. We are really concerned about the clustering in the agricultural area. I know that the consultant stated that the long-term agricultural activity is enhanced by clustering. But I assume that is compared to agricultural activity where you have large lot development. It is not a comparison between a place where only agriculture and its associated activities, its associated housing is permitted, and residential development that is not related to agriculture is not permitted. This plan should protect agriculture, really protect agriculture, and not simply the financial interests of farmers that want to be able to develop. I mean, that should be a major point of this plan, is protecting this small amount. I mean, the Highlands is not that big. The agricultural area is not that big. It is a pretty small area. And any more residential development in it, clustered or not, is just going to destroy it. It's going to destroy the food capability, and it's certainly going to destroy the agritourism and the visual and the scenic aspects. There have got to be found ways to keep residential clusters out that are not directly related to the farm itself. And related to that, the visuals that were shown of clustering in the protection zone and the conservation zone, frankly, I was appalled. The point of this act was to preserve the water, which means to protect the forests. And the forests were where the development was put. I know that visually, I mean, in my town, we have development in forests, and yes, it does hide it, but it is not doing what the act is requiring us to do. So that is a real cautionary thing about recommending. I was just appalled, frankly. I just felt that those examples specifically did not address what this act is supposed to do. Thank you.
My name is Elliot Ruga, also of the newly formed New Jersey Highlands Coalition, and I just have a couple of comments. Where water fees were mentioned, I can't read my handwriting under what program specifically that was mentioned, but would that apply as well to people who draw water from private wells? Because that does deplete
aquifers. We don't get into a question and answer session here, so make your comment whether you think it should or not.
I'm suggesting that it should, because that will deplete aquifers as well. Okay. And in the Forest Resource Management and Sustainability Program, I would suggest that if there is a mitigation plan that is in place, that it is specified as to the size of the trees that are replaced and the species of trees as well. And in a bow to our the historical assets of the Highlands region and the recognition of the historic assets in the regional master plan, that wherever ecotourism and agrotourism is mentioned, that heritage tourism as well be mentioned, as long as it's not at a detriment to the policies of the regional master plan. Thanks.
Thank you. What do you mean the newly formed Highlands Coalition? Seems to me there's a group by that name we've heard of for a while.
Well, I'm a newly formed employee.
You're new to it. Okay.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Monique Purcell, Department of Agriculture. I just wanted to commend actually the staff and the consultant on the clustering discussion. I thought it was very positive. We have some concerns around it, but all in all, I think it's very positive. Just to address Wilma's point, I just want to let her know there is a way to keep residential units out of agricultural areas, and that's why we have TDR. TDR is a critical tool to do just that. Clustering provides us the mechanism to develop land patterns in a completely different way. To be able to have TDR receiving areas, we need to be able to cluster. So, you know, let's not confuse the difference between what clustering would allow versus how it's needed as a tool to implement TDR and also to allow for small development patterns to occur throughout the region without losing the entire region to large lots. So it's very important to keep that in mind, and I would strongly urge the council to adopt the staff recommendations on the 19th. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
May I ask Monique a question?
Yeah, sure.
I
it's not an argument, it's a clarification. When you say we need to have clustering to do TDR, I don't think that's true, because if receiving area simply wouldn't be designated. That's if it's a goal is to put TDR into these agricultural areas. Now, did I misunderstand you, or is that what?
No, I'm saying clustering is the ability to bring units closer together. Obviously, that's what we need to have if we're going to establish TDR receiving areas.
Within agricultural areas.
If in fact there's some areas in marginal agricultural areas where we may have to identify a receiving area, yes, that's true. To be able to save more land, that's the way we're going to get to it. Because some of those will be in existing community zones, I understand that. But in areas where we may have to develop a new hamlet, for example, that's where that would happen. So therefore, clustering is necessary.
Thank you.
David Show. For those of you who thought you dodged the bullet because you were in the planning area, in terms of the devastation of your net worth due to your property ownings, I want to welcome you to the preservation area. Welcome to my world. Welcome to the colony. And here is your colonial administration right here. In regards to that, as part of the county lawsuit, in which I'm also a litigant, we submitted, as part of our arguments, reports from Halshauer and Hollenstein. You should have it here because you are a named defendant in the lawsuit. That doesn't mean that you, the council, have seen it. You should have it over there. One of the things that Mike Hollenstein concludes is that the loss in developed assets just in the preservation area, this number has now grown because now it includes a huge hunk of the planning area, was $80 billion. That's B with a billion. Using DEP's own analysis of the elimination of 215,000 building lots in the Highlands area, multiplied simply by the average price of a home, you get $80 billion. When you apply a factor of two, because for each thing that is built in the area, whether it be a home or a business, it generates economic activity around it, whether you spend money at the local grocery store because you live there now or whatever the reason may be, that figure becomes $160 billion. The direct loss in landowner equity as a result of this is $15 billion. That's what the landowners in the preservation area have lost. Welcome to the planning area, landowners. I understand D'Amico's letter is now available. And any one of you on the council that would like copies of this and can't get them from your staff, let me know, and I will be glad to provide them for you. I also asked, and you cite the gospel often enough, you should be able to lay your hands on it easily, the gospel being the medically peer-reviewed literature, in case there's more than one report, that indicates the negative health benefits of nitrates in drinking water, 10 milligrams per liter. In the water deficit areas, I've been saying this over and over again, it is ridiculous to have a HUC 14 water deficit area in the same area that allegedly provides water for 5-point-some-odd million people in the state. And the simple cure for a water deficit area is for those people that live in that area to use the surface water, not the groundwater. I go back to the colonial nature of this act, where this area is being exploited for its natural resources to the benefit of others, with the others paying nothing. I've lived in a colony, I know how they work. And lo and behold, I'm living in another one. On ag viability, again, I've asked you to get information from the U.S. Department of Agriculture indicating what agricultural viability is in the state on a county-by-county basis. It is rarely viable. It's a myth. And I've read the report on agritourism. It's a joke. The sample size is 48 farmers from throughout the state. From this, you make a policy basis that agritourism is going to work. It won't work. You'll have one farm competing with the other, one right next to the other, for a few precious dollars. Forget it. This thing is simply more than a land grab. It's nothing more than a land grab for the benefit of the majority part of the state, which, of course, begs the question that New Jersey refuses to answer. How are the interests of the minority protected from the assault on them by the majority? New Jersey says that's not an issue for us. There is no protection for the minority from the oppressive aspects of the majority. Certainly not in this case.
Other comments?
Good afternoon. Kellen Heinrich, representing the Farm Bureau members incorporated in the Highlands. I brought some material I want to pass out to you that I hope you will look at between now and the 19th as you deliberate about, you know, what you heard today and what you're going to be asked to vote on at that time. But first of all, it sounds to me like what used to be pre-conformance is now sort of incorporated in general in these policy statements. And I'm wondering, and I wish you'd answer this, but I think we need to know, are all these guidelines and so forth that are in the programs going to be, if they're going to be done before the day you adopt it, is there going to be public discussion, council discussion, of the language that's in those tools and any other policies that might come up? I hope so, because the devil is in the details, and you know, everybody would like to know what you have in mind.
The answer is yes.
Okay, and it's not clear to me that what is going to be done before you adopt and what might be put off to later. It was a little bit clearer in the pre-conformance and conformance division. But, you know, it would be nice to know. I think Charlie kind of promised that a lot would be in the plan, so I hope we can live up to that. But, you know, it's a huge task, but if possible, that would be good. Second thing is, I'm really struck by the fear that some of you have, having been municipal officials, that somehow this plan isn't going to be tough enough to prevent municipalities changing their politics and eradicating all the good work they might have done to conform and their conformance to the standards. It seems to me that you have the power, every one of you, isn't this true, to call up a municipal project. So, you know, it's not the last word when the planning board makes a decision. You all can call it up and rediscuss it here, and frankly, I expect you'll be doing this a lot. but your first opportunity is in shaping the municipal master plan and the zoning ordinance, and you know, I'm sure that you know you're going to be doing that to conform with every aspect of the plan. So I just don't understand the fear, and we sit out here maybe fearing that the municipalities aren't going to have much to say about it at all. It's the opposite.
Okay.
I have a couple of handouts here that I'm giving to you now to make sure you have them.
Thank you. Are you done? Do you have more you want to say?
No, I want to tell you what's in here just briefly. If you could pass these around. Okay. And they pertain to the question of clustering. The Highlands plan has got to permit clustering if you are serious about water quality protection, if you're serious about not losing farmland to large lot development, and if you're serious about the character of the Highlands, which has been very aptly described. One thing I'm passing out is a publication of the South Branch Watershed Association a few years ago, Preserving Rural Character. And this is talking about land use planning with alternative wastewater systems. And they felt, they had a committee that studied this, and they felt that there's no way that the development can happen without ruining rural character unless you are permitted to incorporate those. There's a letter also pointing out that municipality is not the only barrier to that. The DEP has been brought along as well. The second thing, I just put together what I think is a challenge to you, that you alone can make these clusters successful from, you know, the farmer's point of view and also yours. And there's a lot of problems with the way they've been done in the past, and I think if you look at this, I'll point some of them out. For example, the farmer ought to be able to do a cluster without losing the farm and the ability to farm, and there are ways to do that. The farmer ought to be able to hold on to that equity and never use it. I mean, everyone seems to assume that if you can cluster, they're going to run right out and do it, and this is not the case. And the farmer should be able to maybe develop a plot plan of the cluster and develop only part of it if they just need money to put their money to their mother in a nursing home or something like that. But as Monique pointed out, the ability to cluster at a certain density is one of the protective tools for equity, and it makes it possible to do much better planning solutions for the development that's going to happen. And I'm very glad to see that clustering could happen in all three zones, because it's got to be clear that that's the way we want things done and not continue the typical suburban pattern. there are some, on the second page, there's some things that need to be done about clustering, and I hope you'll add that to your legislative agenda to make it better. Everybody can point to bad examples, and I can tell you why they ended up that way. And it's not absolutely necessary. The last thing, I'm going to give just a copy to John and to Eileen. Jeff LaJava asked me to substantiate my belief that with TDR, all along he said that natural resources, people with natural resource land should be able to participate in TDR. And so that's what I've done. I've examined a bunch of documents, and even after the day you adopted the criteria, right up to your goals, policies, and objectives, you're still talking about giving credits for natural resources. So it was a total shock to read that you can only do that if you turn in your exemptions. So thank you very much, and we will see you on the 19th, and you know, we have a lot of homework to do too. So thank you.
Thank you.
My name is Dave Pfeiffer. I'm with the Association of New Jersey Environmental Commissions. I want to compliment the staff on pushing out massive quantities of information, and we are peddling hard trying to make sense of it. I wanted to give some very brief comments on what I read and heard today, although doing the analysis justice in the time is not possible. First comment has to do with updates and map amendments. And I think the council needs to ask itself a very important question, and that is, are you comfortable making a no-net loss decision when it comes to map amendments? How you know what a net loss is, how you know what's positive, what's negative, and how does that balance? Or would you prefer a more bright-line decision-making framework? And we saw some of that presented today with regard to changing specific types of areas. And I think that as we struggled with the freshwater wetlands program in New Jersey and the federal program and the policy of no net loss, we realized how difficult that is and how that can be spun. So think about how you're going to live with this plan over a long period of time, and perhaps you may wish for a more structured approach to decision making. Two other comments on that same subject of map adjustments. Number one, I would support Tracy's idea of limiting the scale of these changes in the community. We don't want every inch of everything up for grabs in every community in the Highlands. You'll never be able to cope with it. And secondly, then you might want to think about the limiting the number or timing of requests for map changes as a process element going forward over time. We have an interesting prohibition, for example, against minor subdivision in the municipal land use law that doesn't allow you to keep stacking them up. You have to come in for a major. So at some point, you might want to restrict the timing and number of requests, as well as the size or scale of those requests. I have a number of questions, which I'll try to take offline, about the cluster development provision. A very simple kinds of questions. How far is adjacent? That's an interesting problem. The word appurtenant would cure that problem. And we find that all the time in land preservation issues.
I thought it was 200 feet.
Well, yeah, it might well be. If you say so, it could be. No. The next one is the calculation of the percentage, and the question really is how percentage of what? Is it the percentage of the parcel, the commonly owned land, the land owned by the same owner scattered throughout the municipality, or the zone? And we've seen the council sort of go into that zone thing once before. So that really needs to be clarified, I think. And then finally, on the 10 milligrams per liter nitrate issue, please don't make the mistake of thinking that a health standard is a planning standard. A planning standard has to have a margin of safety for error. You cannot allow groundwater anywhere to degrade to the health standard as a planning issue. So there's a difference between planning and zoning and actual health impact. And please recognize that and revisit that 10 milligram per liter cluster limit. Land preservation, some components that I think would be very helpful is if the council would commit to providing some form of information for landowners, particularly with regard to tax treatment of donations and other purchase less than fee transactions. These can have powerful impacts on families and land ownership, which can be very positive. Being ignorant of them can hurt you very badly financially And I think it would be well for the council to consider an information pack about tax advice. I would suggest that the council also look very carefully at what tax treatment might be available at the state level for encouraging donations. We have very good, right now, some of the best federal conditions ever for private land donation. But our state tax advantage package is a little inadequate compared to some other states. The issue of coordinating your activities with the private land trust community should be part of the program. You should be in regular communication with them. You should understand their priorities, their activities, and harmonize them with yours. With regard to the water quality restoration component, we had submitted testimony previously about specific water monitoring requirements, and this may come into the science program as well, with regard to monitoring the conservation area for agricultural impacts in water quality. We know that we have, in some areas, thermal impacts, turbidity impacts, nitrogen, phosphorus, herbicides, and pesticides. And when you're setting up your monitoring program and you're intending a land use like agriculture to go on in those areas, and you want to facilitate it and foster it, you need to monitor its potential impacts on the public trust. The transportation safety and mobility section doesn't include air transit or air transport. You have some airports within the Highlands. You have some growth potential in those airports. You also have airports that are outside the Highlands that may, if enlarged, expanded, or managed differently, impact the Highlands area. So please consider air as part of transport. On the federal, state, and regional agency coordination, some mention or approach needs to be made to the Department of Energy, the FAA, and FERC. You've got impacts coming your way right now in the Highlands that are coming from those agencies. Things that I haven't seen that I'd like to see in the RMP. I'd like to see you address the subject of climate change. The Highlands can anticipate impacts from climate change, and it can play a role in mitigating impacts of climate change. And this plan's going to be around a long time, so I would hope that you take a look at it from what you can see in 2007 right now. It would be interesting to try to identify a set of indicators that could be monitored, and that may be something that you'd want to link with your science agenda as well. And then we suggest that there be a periodic review of those indicators and a report back to the continuing planning process. There's nothing that I've seen that addresses, as a separate section, energy in the plan. This was an initial comment back when we saw the original RMP. Again, for those reasons that energy impacts will be visited on the Highlands, and the Highlands can contribute something to mitigating energy problems. Something we need very desperately for the conformance process is some kind of a joint memo, guidance, whatever you'd like to call it, between OSP, OSG on one side, and the Highlands Council on the other, to clarify the relationships between Highlands conformance and plan endorsement. We're running up on this every day in the field. So think about that. The next comment, it relates to that, and it's more in the form of a question, and I think Helen hit on it as well. What can we expect as releases and material to work with for working with the public and for the public to understand the new RMP. We would like to know that very much. I'd like to say another thing that has been a comment over and over about the limestone areas that are now, thankfully, in the plan. If you look at your septic yield map, you'll see you've got your highest septic yields on your very best aquifers. Is that where you want them to be? And is that the most, is that the wisest thing to do with protecting groundwater quality in those areas? I'd like to comment on the, and compliment the use of the computer visualizations we saw today. That is very persuasive stuff, and I would encourage more use of that, particularly when we get out to working with towns in the area. So think about using that technology a little more. And that's all I have. Thank you.
Anything else? Thanks.
Hi, Susan Buck, Oxford. Haven't been able to make it for the last couple months, but I've been following what's going on the internet when the Highlands Council technology allows it to be published, which isn't all the time, so I may have missed a few things. But it feels like this second RMP manifesto is going about the same way that the first RMP manifesto went, and fundamental principles and policies are happening without voting on them, without that much discussion, and with very few questions. I'm concerned that we're going to end up exactly where we were before, and some of these underlying things are just not sustainable for the future. Since I haven't heard a lot of the questions asked, I'm going to ask a bunch of questions, but I know they're rhetorical, but at least they'll be out there. It seems that most of this is like just stuff from today, but basically, like, what does a human being need to survive in the Highlands? Has that question been answered yet? We know how much a salamander needs, and it comes out to exactly 360 times more land than a human being needs in a TDR receiving zone. I'm not sure if we shouldn't be questioning that concept. Why is the human growth capacity going to be done as a simple table introduced at the last minute when we have hundreds, if not thousands, of pages dedicated to what the capacity and needs are of various critters that live in the Highlands? Why would we restrict outside lighting in a lake area when they're known to be overpopulated by black bears? If I was living there and I'm a parent, I'm sorry, I'm breaking that law, because I'm not having my child go outside and get eaten by a bear because I'm not allowed to turn on my outside light to ruin the scenery. And what does a height restriction have in the place of a lake management zone? These things just don't make any sense to me whatsoever. Why do meaningful employment opportunities and affordable housing have to be offered when a town wants to negotiate a line on the map? And they're not being offered to us. There are no meaningful employment opportunities. There is no more affordable housing. How does transferring the majority of a farmer's property rights to the government and to nonprofits result in sustainable agriculture? How does sustainable agriculture happen when most of the things on that list had to do with we shall implement regulations that do such and such? This doesn't contribute to the sustainability of agriculture. It saves the land for God knows what purpose. Farmers need, all you have to do is offer the farmer the ability to make a living, and it would be real nice to see us offer our young people the opportunity of going into farming as a career. Nobody even considers that. When we're dead, farming's dead. It's already not financially sustainable. I keep hoping to see things that could make it financially sustainable again, but there's absolutely nothing in there, again, that addresses that issue. Why is the identification of willing sellers on the to-do list? I don't know anybody that wouldn't sell. All you got to do is write them out a check for what the property is worth without the Highlands Act. We're out of here. It's yours. You don't have to spend any time or money identifying us. I'll give you the mailing list if you want it. why are we spending money on promoting tourism? We don't even have the tourist facilities, and we're not allowed to build them anyway, so why invest in that? Let the Park Service take care of it. The only land that exists for tourism is the parks. Let them handle it. Keep the Highlands money for the Highlands. Why are we spending time and money developing agrotourism? Any farmer that is on a busy road has probably thought of that concept already. We don't need any help with that. The people that aren't on the busy roads might need an idea for how to do it, but they're not going to do it with agrotourism. The people that wanted to are. Right, the earlier comment that if there's any more, they're going to be competing with each other. The busy roads are all filled with them. We have all the pumpkin picking that we need. And what does a municipal tree ordinance doing in the forest management thing? This is like insidious. It has nothing to do with managing a core forest. You know, if your municipality wants to have a tree ordinance, that's fine, but it has no place in a forest management plan. And what is a green forest product? Don't know what that is. And what is a community forest plan? I don't know what that is. I mean, the DEP is already telling me what to do. You guys are going to tell me what to do. Now my township's going to tell me what to do with my forest. I don't get what that's supposed to be all about. And why my township even bother spending a whole lot of money developing one. Why does the master plan continue to ignore the Constitution? We're addressing all kinds of things, but we still haven't addressed the Constitution. There are property rights. There's even horrible capitalist ideals that need to be maintained. We need to continue to earn a living. We need to continue to enjoy property rights. We don't want to be handing things over to the third party thing. And the third party thing, this was kind of new. I heard it on one of the recordings, and now I heard it here a lot today. I don't understand this concept of handing over monitoring of our property to third party interests. That scares me. I don't know what that means. I don't know what it's doing in the regional master plan, but it's going to be real problematic. You cannot do that. Either you have an enforcement agency that's responsible for enforcing the laws, and that's who should be responsible for it. So if it's the DEP or the Highlands Council, I don't care. But to hand that over to a nonprofit agency where there's no accountability to the lawmaking body, it's taking it one further step away from the legislature. It's not workable. All of those references, I think, should come in. Thanks.
Thank you. Other comments? Anyone else wish to speak?
Yes.
Final speaker.
Marion Harris, Morris County Trust for Historic Preservation. And I've got to tell you, in the minutes that you approved, not half an hour since, and some of you were even sitting in the room at the time that the meeting was happening, there is an egregious boo-boo, that is a substantive error. I don't usually look to see my name in print, but it's a good thing I did this time, because what it says in here is the opposite of what it should say. This is the sentence that says that the council should do design review because the state and municipalities are not doing it. That's just the opposite of the situation. First of all, the issue of historic architectural design review is something that I did raise the question about, and I was talking to Tom, and he understands very well what the problem is. There is a question about your legal authority to do historic design review, because currently, under state law, the only way that can be done is by SHPO or by a municipal commission. And as far as whether you ought to be able to do design review, there are reasons now why you shouldn't do it, and that the main one is that you don't so far have anybody on the staff who can do it. I hear some good news about that, and that may change. But even so, then there's the issue of what your legal authority would be to do that kind of review. I'm talking about the kind of decision that decides whether a particular architectural design is appropriate in context. I'm not talking about the kind of design review that verges on site plan authority where you say move the driveway over. That's partly design, but it's also partly a practical thing. But this historic design stuff is beyond your reach at the moment. And what's terrifying is that, and this is something that I did talk about last time, is that there have been some forms of your plans that indicate that you would like to punt those decisions to the municipal commissions. And what we talked about was the disaster that would be if you did that. I've been talking to SHPO about this lately, and I have a feeling that their resistance to doing it for you is beginning to wear down. But don't tell them I said that. In any case, they know that it's a legal problem for you. Just as long as everybody is talking about clustering, I would like to add one more point about clustering, which is that it pains me to hear it talked about as a purely planning concept and not at all as a design concept, because there are ways that you could do clustering in the Highlands that would be entirely appropriate to the ways that it has grown. But if you arrange these clusters in modern ways, for instance, in a set of townhouses or all around a cul-de-sac, you're clustering all right, but you're not doing something that ought to happen in the Highlands. So it isn't as if clustering should be thrown out altogether, but you have to do it in accordance with some sort of design standards in order not to make it intrusive.
Thank you. Our next meeting, I think this is obvious, but it's likely to be fairly lengthy, so I encourage members and the public, too, to be prepared for that. Is there anything else I can ask for you? A motion to adjourn?
No.
Second?
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Vote. Thank you all.
So, you still wait for the first job.
Congratulations. I didn't sign up for that.